came out.
I mean, well, and it's also a substitute for what I was talking about with Cossack the other night. It's a substitute for Goya. Goya meaning get off your ass. You know what? If you're tweeting 18 out of 24 hours a day, odds are pretty damn good you're not out in the street. Whatever it is that's worth being out in the street over, you're not, because you're sitting there glued to your timeline, right?
Well, you know that's for another discussion of how the computer is helping and hindering progressive causes, and I would say that there is more of a percentage that the computer is not helping with the progressive cause for what you just stated right there.
Well, to the extent that the computer and so-called information sharing platforms are a digital form of what Aldous Huxley called Soma in Brave New World.
Right, right, right.
Well, to the extent that it's digital Soma, I think it fits some people's agenda quite nicely.
I mean, it gets you so distracted. Like people who have dedicated their lives to like online games, like World of Warcraft, and sell their homes and stuff like that. I mean, I think that's we're definitely heading down that path, or we're already at the end of that path, or we really don't know where we're at right now because the line is so blurred.
It's, yeah, you mean the line, but if I understand correctly.
When I'm talking about, there's so many mirrors now, and there's so many distractions. And just like what you said with that Wienergate, it gives you an indication of how fast stories can go off and running and get you off the subject of what you're after for the causes that you're passionate about. And the right wing is so good at this. They're so amazing and so diabolical at that because, basically, it's the fact they never give in to the fact that they did something immorally wrong. They never apologize.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, apology not being in the lexicon for some quadrants of what you're describing.
I did just want to end this on a great note that I think you'll find interesting. Apparently in Egypt, they just brought back 3 shots of the Chamber of Secrets and the Great Pyramid.
Oh, really?
First time in 4,500 years, you get a floor shot, you get a wall shot.
Cool. I saw a story the other day that said... remote imaging from like space,
yeah,
has uncovered something like 3,000 unknown pyramids.
Wow!
You know, just covered in the shifting sands over the aeons and the eras, and you know they're not 3,000 pyramids of Cheops.
I'm gonna have to look into that. And just one final note, I think if when they fire that Hawass guy, they need to start getting out a little bit of dynamite and put it in the shaft so they can get that robot all the way in. That's my personal feeling.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, get that stuff out of the way.
Get it in there, because I don't think they can. I think they've hit the end, and there needs.
Zahi Hawass is just. I've seen him on so many documentaries. He's such a camera stoot.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch him. But anyways, Bob, great talking to you, and I look forward to whatever else the week entails. And one last thing, RIP to Gil Scott-Heron.
I was about to say, I want to make sure that is how we ended this evening.
One of the great songs of our time, and for people who think that he was just a poet, should actually look into his work with Brian Jackson, who's an amazing keyboardist to Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock. And what's amazing about it is the fact that Gil Scott-Heron was transformed from being a poet and a writer, which is already an amazing accomplishment in itself, but when he found the musical voice of Brian Jackson, he became an effective songwriter.
Well, and in reading the bio, I was also impressed by the fact that from age 2 to age 12, he lived with his grandma in Jackson, Tennessee, and that's where he learned to play the piano. Southern connection comes through again.
Yeah, so Southern indeed. Well, anyway, Bob, great talking to you.
All right, take care, David. Bye now.
All right, later.
Yeah, let's take a minute before we go for this. I hope I've got good audio.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news.
That rises, and I'm sorry we're running out of time, that rises to the level of prophecy. Go listen to it on YouTube. He was talking about in 1971 things that are reality in 2011. 40 years ago. Thanks, everybody. I hope you had a happy Memorial Day weekend. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, from Lottie, our chat room moderator, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, Ben Birch, John Fox, Reverbo, Matt Osborne, thanks. And thanks most of all to those of you who contribute to keep this all on the air, because it's the only way it happens. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Head on to Bob Kincaid, 3 hours. hours of conversation, cussing, and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Tuesday, and a lovely one it is here in the hills and hollers of what's left of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. I thought this evening, we've got rather of a hodgepodge this evening. No, not really. It's just things don't always string together in that logical fashion that I rather like. But you know what? I promised myself I was going to do this so that folks will, hey, what happened to Bob? Okay, let's go over this again. Beginning next week, it gets kind of weird. All right? I leave on the 7th of June, so I won't be behind the mic the 7th of June, the 8th of June, and probably not the 9th of June. Definitely not the 10th of June. We'll be traveling to Washington, D.C., a number of us, in order to highlight the assault that has been going on against the Environmental Protection Agency and try to give them a little bit of backup, a little bit of support for their efforts, their lonely efforts, because they are the only agency in government that
or simply standing aside to let it happen. The outcome is the same either way to us. If leaders aren't blocking the wrecking ball and advancing working families' interest, then working people will not support them.
Trumka says AFL-CIO is redoing its entire political program intent on supporting only politicians who support workers. The U.S. Labor Department is suing the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services Child Protective Services Division for not paying overtime to hundreds of its employees. The suit alleges that 800 current and former investigators and caseworkers were denied the payments which are required under federal labor law. The suit seeks more than $1 million in back wages plus damages. New York City public workers have been cleared of intentional work slowdown allegations, Jesse Russell reports.
Do you remember all of the hoopla last December surrounding a New York City councilman who alleged he had evidence of an intentional work slowdown during one of the winter's worst blizzards? Well, last Friday, a report was finally released essentially exonerating city workers of any perceived wrongdoing. The report filed by the New York City Department of Investigation found that there was no evidence of a slowdown and that Councilman Daniel Halloran had no actual evidence that such a slowdown actually happened. Halloran was unable to produce evidence that city employees really had told him they were obstructing snow cleanup. The report did have one benefit, as it showed the city where it could improve in the future. For example, nearly half of the snow chains on trucks broke, and some workers became stuck in drifts for as long as 12 hours. Halloran, for his part, issued a statement saying the investigation didn't result in any definite conclusion regarding his statements, and he touted the courage of his convictions to take on the city.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hello, Detroit. Auto worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickmithshow.com. On Wednesday, the Saigon Daily News had an interesting story, one I don't think you'd see in many American newspapers. And, you know, I'll read it right from the paper. The Vietnamese markets are being flooded with a mass of cheap, poor quality, and toxic Chinese products. with many stores selling Chinese toys without labels of manufacturing or the CR guarantee marks. And this is the part that gets me, that they put in this. Regardless, stores continue to sell the goods for their high profit margins, knowing full well of the dangers of toxic poisoning to children who play with the toys tainted with toxic chemicals like DEHP or lead, which causes cancer or sterility. Don't see many of those stories here, but you know, in Vietnam, evidently they maybe they see things a little differently. But it brings me back to, why can't we make our toys here? When I was a kid, basically all of my toys were made in this country by workers who made a reasonable living and did it in a way that, you know, they weren't going to use toxic stuff, because their kids played with it too. It's amazing to me. I've got Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, on the line to talk about this. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, I look at this story, and again, we don't see these kind of stories in our newspapers very often, where it's laid right out of the line. Yeah, these companies know that these toys are toxic. They know they're going to harm children, but hey, high profit margins, we're going to sell them anyway.
You're right. I mean, the only time you might possibly read about a story in the United States is if there's been an official recall. That does happen more often than it should. But that's it. It's striking, because while there is kind of silence in the media about this, it's a kitchen table conversation. And if you talk to moms or dads who are buying toys, I mean, they will go into the Toys R Us or the big box store and they'll buy the toys, but they're not particularly happy about it, and they'd like some options. Right. They really would, and it's very frustrating.
But it's hard to get options when you've got a country like China, who is, you know, they're hell-bent on being the world's manufacturer, because they know that by building things, by producing products, adding value to stuff, that they're going to be the superpower of the next generation, because they've got the ability to create wealth.
Well, you got it. And it starts with toys and it goes up the value chain, but they certainly value manufacturing, the economic power that it brings, the trade surplus that it brings, the employment opportunity that it brings. And to be honest, our political culture and the culture of our elites just says, we don't need those jobs anymore. We'll do something else. And for a couple of decades, that's been the prevailing theory, and in both parties, unfortunately, and it's shown to be completely false. We've tried it. We're in an economic mess, and we've lost a tremendous amount of capacity, both in terms of people who are working in manufacturing and also goods that we don't produce anymore. If we ever want to have a shot at becoming a great manufacturing country again, we're going to have to do things a lot differently than we do them now.
Yeah, you know, I remember going back to 2009 when the president was pushing the Recovery Act, and one of the key components for me was this Buy American provision, where if there are things that we can buy here at home, we should do that. We should be supporting domestic production. We should be supporting the people who are working in this country first, and then if you can't find it, then, of course, you know, you have to go where you have to go, but you know, buy it at home first.
That's right. And it's common sense when it comes to the government. Look, if you're going to spend tax dollars that taxpayers are contributing, taxpayers should have the first shot at doing the work. No question about it.
Yeah.
And it's something that has been in American law for about 70 or 80 years, and it hasn't been particularly strictly enforced, and it's been eroded through other trade agreements that we've done. And it was interesting that, you know, it became a big issue for the stimulus money, even though Ronald Reagan thought that Buy America policies were okay. He screwed up a lot of other things, but he at least saw the logic in that, and you know, the president practically had to apologize for it.
Well, I got to be honest. I think the thing with Reagan, and you know, I'm definitely not somebody who's going to defend him, but I think the times were different. I think the people were different. The consumers were different. The workers were different. They would have demanded. If we would have had a stimulus package back under Reagan that said, "Oh no, we're not going to buy American products," I think there'd have been a revolution.
You're right. And there was a fierce competition with Japan at the time that most people, if they were alive at the time, probably remember.
I do.
And Reagan was pretty aggressive. I mean, you know, not aggressive enough according to some, but he did more than any Republican today would ever do, or frankly, any Democrat would do. And they were different times. You know, here we are. You know, 20, 30 years later, we have a larger trade surplus. We have another competitor, China. And instead of, you know, getting tough with them, we just kind of turn the other cheek. And it's driven us further into debt. We have more trade deficits. We've lost millions of manufacturing jobs. We're left wondering what our kids are going to do. And, you know, it's certainly not how we won the Cold War, how we became the world's greatest economic power. It's just, I mean, we didn't seem to learn that lesson. And now we find ourselves in the unenviable position of, you know, facing being number two or worse a decade from now and wondering where jobs for our kids are going to come from.
You know, it's interesting you brought up the trade deficit because I look at Washington, and all I keep hearing about is the deficit, all the debt and the deficit, and we need to cut spending, cut. Yet I hear no one talking about the massive trade deficits we have with like China, considering the fact that they're cheating us like crazy, they're eating our lunch, they're beating us up at every turn, but nobody seems to want to take that on.
You're right. And, you know, obviously everyone should be concerned about our long-term fiscal position. No question about that. We eventually want to try to balance our books.
But here's the thing. If we had a balanced trade, if we had balanced trade, would we have the massive budget deficits that we had? I mean, I think they would level themselves out.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, there have been studies done in different states by dramatically different institutions, including some very conservative ones, that have said if each state would have held its share of manufacturing jobs over the last decade, every state budget would be in balance. You wouldn't have to do anything. And it's because of the wealth that manufacturing creates and the fact that you wouldn't have those trade deficits. And, Rick, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you get the unemployment rate down, if you get economic growth up and you have measures to do that, our debt will go down. It is just common sense. If you're going to cut, and you're going to forego investments in innovation and infrastructure and skills and training and education, we're going to be worse off than we were before. And we might have brought the budget deficit down by a couple $100 billion in a year, but our economy is not going to grow. We're not going to create the jobs we need to do, and our long-term fiscal position is going to worsen. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, because after, you know, up until November, you know, when the Republicans ran on this, we're going to create jobs. That's all we heard about up until November. The day after the elections, it turned up to about, oh, let's see how much we can give away to the top 1% and make everybody else suffer. That's what it seemed like to me.
Well, you're right. And unfortunately for the Democrats that were running, I think that the election was much more of a referendum on the economy than than it was on Republican plans to do anything about it. I don't think that folks were particularly happy about that plan. But you're right. I mean, the new members came in. And they have a blind obsession with cutting spending. Nothing else matters. And as a result, that's what's dominated the debate for the last 5 or 6 months here in this Congress. And the word jobs has not cropped up. I mean, the only thing that the Republicans have offered are plans from the Bush era, which certainly didn't work, as, you know, the 8 years of the Bush era showed. It was the worst record of private sector job creation that we've had in our country since the Great Depression. And I don't see the debate moving forward, and I'm a bit frustrated, I have to say, with our president, who, instead of saying, let's focus on jobs, let's talk about jobs, let's have a job strategy, let's have a manufacturing strategy, let's learn from the example of Germany and other countries that are doing much better off than we are right now because they make things.
Yep.
Instead of saying that, he's saying, well, I'll meet you halfway on the debt. And he's playing on their turf, and I think it's the wrong approach, and I don't think it's what Democrats want to hear at all.
And it's not what I want to hear, and it's one of the things that we've been talking about in this program. You know, it's the whole, do we borrow money or do we slash programs? I say we start taxing people who have a lot of who did very well during the Bush years. Maybe that get some of that $2.5 trillion that we handed out back. Maybe just that's an idea. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Scott Paul. He is the executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org. You know, one of the things that Mitch McConnell this week said, he and Orrin Hatch accused the president of being schizophrenic on trade. And his, I guess his rationale is that, gee, you want to protect those workers who are going to be displaced by these three really NAFTA-like agreements. Because the president wants them to fund the TAA so that when people do lose their jobs, there's someone to help, somewhere to help them get back on their feet. Republicans dead set against helping those people. And that somehow makes the president schizophrenic. What are your thoughts on these three trade agreements? There's some differences between each of them, but as a package.
Well, I will say this, that, you know, any elected officials that is touting these three free trade agreements as being some sort of an economic boon, hasn't read the trade agreements or hasn't looked at history. I mean, you may have other reasons for doing trade agreements, but arguing that they're going to create a lot of jobs shouldn't be one of them, because that simply hasn't been the case. And, you know, there are other moral objections, I think, to doing the agreement with Colombia as written, as long as they're killing trade unionists. I will say this, Rick. You know, if you're going to have a free trade agreement, you know, Korea is the type of country you want to do it with. They have a middle class. They have unions. You know, they have disposable income. Theoretically, they could buy our products. But under the terms of the Korea agreement, you know, when you're trading back and forth across the border, it's considered an American good or a Korean good if it's only 35% domestic content. Yep. And that opens up a huge window for China to get in there. So it's not, you know, not a great, you know, kind of setup for American manufacturing to win there. And certainly all three of those trade agreements combined, you know, even looking at the rosiest scenarios of the proponents of them and what they would do, is a fraction of the problem that we have with China. And you see zero attention paid to the trade deficit with China, especially by the Republican Party. And all you see is hammering Obama on the FTAs for not being aggressive enough, and then for trying to link them with worker assistance. And it is a, you know, that's kind of a debatable strategy, but the Republicans are on very shaky grounds here, saying that the free trade agreements are some sort of a panacea for jobs, because history has shown that's not the case.
I mean, just looking at the fact that they refuse to extend the TAA, you know, to help people who may be displaced, tells me that they don't even believe their rhetoric, because if it was going to create all the jobs that they're claiming it's going to create, there would be no problem. It would be fine.
That's right. And trade adjustment assistance is, I mean, I like the program for job training, because it's actually what a model job training program should be like. It's a shame that we need it, because trade agreements shouldn't cost jobs. And at the very least, it ought to be an essential part of any of these trade deals. And it is a, yeah, I don't know how any of this is going to turn out. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't figure it out. But it is, for Republicans to be saying, yeah, we want to do these free trade agreements, but we don't want to help workers, you know, goes against actually the history of doing the trade agreements, as dubious as it is. And at the very least, if a government policy is going to take your job away, you owe retraining to that worker, at the very least. I mean, you frankly owe them better trade agreements, but, you know, retraining is the absolute minimum that ought to be done.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, one of the things that I have a problem with is, you know, when I take my kids to the store for school clothes or for whatever, you know, half the time we take a global along with us, because it's a geography lesson. I can't find tennis shoes made in the U.S. Other than the one pair that I wear. You can hardly find jeans. You can hardly find anything. And you look at these big box retailers, I don't know that any one is better than the other. Is Target better than Kmart? Is Kmart better than Walmart? Is, you know, I don't see any difference. I see them
right,
doing the same thing, going back to the story, from the Saigon Daily, saying that, you know, they know they're selling crummy products, but the money is just too great.
You know, there's a fascinating thing going on, Rick, and there may be some advantages for American manufacturing that we didn't have. I mean, the dollar's a little weaker. That actually helps our manufacturing position. One unfortunate feature of the recession is that wages are dropping. Again, we're not going to win the future on lower manufacturing wages. But there's also an interesting trend. I mean, at the higher end, it is now chic to do Made in America. I mean, there are all sorts of jeans that are made in Los Angeles now that celebrities wear. Those aren't sold at big box stores because they cost $100 or more for a pair of jeans. And working people aren't going to buy those, nor should they. But the real problem, and you're right about this, are the mass market retailers and their unwillingness to stock their shelves with American-made goods. And they have the power to do that because they drove a lot of American manufacturing offshore by making very unreasonable demands. They certainly have the power to bring it back. And just the last thing I will say about this is smart manufacturers know that Made in America has a huge premium for it. In fact, their sales can increase by up to 30% or more if their product is stamped Made in America, believe it or not. And so there's a real interest in doing that. But as long as you have the Kmarts, the Walmarts, the Home Depots, the Targets and what have you, you know, insisting on impossible to meet prices that could only be subsidized by a government or some other source, it's going to be very hard to recognize that. And so you have this bizarre situation where if you have a lot of disposable income, yeah, you can buy American-made products. You can buy New Balance sneakers. You can buy Viking equipment for your kitchen. You can buy Lucky brand jeans or some other jeans that are made in the United States. Not all Lucky brands are, but you can stock yourself pretty well. But that's not an option that is available to working people right now, and it should be.
Yeah, I agree. You brought up the weaker dollar, and the last thing I wanted to get into is this idea of currency manipulation. You know, the dollar has fallen a little bit, but the Chinese have been actually holding their currency much lower to obviously make their products cheaper in the marketplace. And I've had a couple of people ask me, well, why don't we just keep lowering our dollar? And the reality is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that if we were to do that, they would just drop theirs lower because they've pegged their currency to ours.
Yeah, it's kind of a complicated process, but you know, the value of our dollar has fallen for two reasons. You know, our economy isn't doing great relative to other economies. And actually the one good thing that Ben Bernanke has done at the Federal Reserve is quantitative easing. It's
right.
Put more money out there and it's so weakened the value of the dollar. That really helps our exports. It does. But you're right. What China does is nothing market based. And every day, they buy up enough dollars and sell enough of their own currency that they can maintain a certain peg. Now, they've changed that peg a bit over the last year, and they've strengthened the value of their currency by a little bit, but not nearly enough to make any sort of difference. It's just enough to keep the administration quiet on this. And it is a very destructive policy that harms not only American industry, but Brazil and a lot of other countries around the world. But everyone is afraid to stand up to China. We shouldn't be, but everyone is afraid to stand up to China. The fact is, when you do stand up to China, you get results. The steelworkers have gotten the results on tires, on clean energy, on other things. But first, you got to stand up to them.
Yeah, I mean, again, you look at this, and whose fault is it if we're letting them beat us up and take our lunch money?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, shame on them for taking our jobs, but shame on us for letting them go and not saying anything about it.
Yeah.
They've had a 10-year free ride since they joined the World Trade Organization. They haven't had to live up to the rules because no one told them they had to live up to the rules. Mm-hmm. So Obama's done it a couple of times, and when he's done it, they've actually played by the rules. But, you know, it's the exception rather than the rule that we have here.
I wish campaign Obama would come back and
me too.
And push all those things he ran on. Maybe, you know, here in the coming months we will see a resurgence. Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work there.
Well, Rick, likewise. Keep up the great work that you do every day.
Alrighty, thanks, Scott. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
It's time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who had their tongues running 100 miles an hour but forgot to put their brains in gear. Today, I've got two goobers from last year's teabag uprising, both of whom got elected by promising to bring common sense to Congress and take government back from the special interests. Goober number one is Arizona's Ben Quayle, the son of Dan, and truly a flake off the old block. Ben has proven to be a stand-up guy, not for the folks, but for big oil. While voting to slash government programs to help the elderly and the poor, he has voted not once but twice to keep giving $2 billion in annual tax subsidies to the five richest oil corporations. In a town hall meeting back home, a feisty lady asked him, why? Ben essentially called her ignorant, insisting that big oil was merely getting the same tax deductions that all corporations get. It's not specific to the oil industry, he said, to which the audience burst out laughing. They were right to guffaw, for tax giveaways called intangible drilling costs and enhanced oil recovery costs are obviously specific to that industry. Is Ben lying or just a goober? Our second awardee is Sean Duffy of Wisconsin, who campaigned as a regular guy, but asked at a town hall gathering whether he'd vote to cut congressional pay as a symbolic stand with his hard-hit constituents, Sean fell into a paroxysm of self-pity. I have more debt than all of you, he wailed, adding that he can't even buy a new car on his $174,000 a year paycheck. And Duffy also complained about Congress's health and pension plans, most of which are paid for by us taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Sean, if it's such a burden being a Congress critter, quit and join the real world. What a goober.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program this evening, go to the website and download our podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, but also your convenience. If you can't be here for the whole 3 hours, it's always a good idea to catch up by checking out the podcast. You got any questions, comments, something on your mind, you say, Rick, yeah, I like that, I didn't, whatever, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do appreciate the feedback, especially the negative stuff, which I get quite a bit of, and that's good. It's about having the conversation. That's what this program's about. What I have been getting a lot of positive feedback on is going after this House Bill 916. I think people realize that Scott Perry, representative from the area, this unemployment compensation bill that he tried to ram through was pure poison. This was pure poison top to bottom. This was, to be honest, even he admitted it was far out on the business side. It was, and in his press release, he said, look, you know, honestly, the Chamber of Commerce and the NFIB, they wrote the thing. It was basically like he just turned in their paper. But what 916 was everything that the business community ever wanted. Every fantasy that they could come up with, that's what 916 was. They figured, hey, we got a guy who's willing to take our water. He's willing to carry our pail. Let's fill it up with some stuff that we really, really have always wanted. And that's what 916 was. And now what they've done is they've couched it in some very nice terms. Oh, we just want to make sure people are out looking for jobs. We just want to make sure that, they're not cheating the system. And, when I hear that kind of stuff, I want to smack people upside the head and go, what's happening here is all these folks who are collected unemployment, they got screwed out of their jobs. They got kicked to the curb through no fault of their own. And what the right wants to make it sound like is these people voluntarily quit. Oh, the majority of them, they just quit and they're gaming the system. That 40% of their previous pay really goes a long way in making sure that the mortgage is paid and the lights are on and the kids get fed. Right there. It's beautiful stuff. But some of the other things that they do in this, they take back little portions of it. When I quit my job in Ohio to come to Pennsylvania when my ex-wife had a job, I was able to collect a little bit of unemployment until I found something else. It helped make that transition. So if,
Say somebody over at the war college or someone, you know, in the military has to be moved to another area. Their wife goes with them, her husband goes with them. They're able to collect unemployment, help with the transition. That's a smart thing. It's good stuff. It's the right thing to do, but not according to our Republican, not our business friends. Our business friends want to say, well, you want to go tough, nothing for you. And the other part of that is, you know, they call those voluntary quit. You know, there's a component of this that, you know, a woman who's in a domestic violence situation, when she quits her job to get away from someone harassing her, now we're gonna hold that off. So there's going to be no way of having that argument where we should be extending that benefit. And the other thing that they're doing, and this is another one of these language things, they're removing the willful misconduct from the misconduct. It's just going to be misconduct. We're going to be able to fire you for any reason now. And if we fire you for any reason, no unemployment. Because remember, Pennsylvania is an at-will state. If, you know, I come into work tomorrow and I don't like the guy that works for me, I can fire him. No questions asked. And his only recourse is to go file for unemployment. Now I'll be able to fight that. Isn't that a great thing? You're already an at-will state, and now that the only recourse that used to be there has been taken away from workers. This is just a plain shame. The other part of it's a real screw job to low-wage workers. They're raising the minimum amount of weekly gross incomes from $50 a week up to $115. And I'm going, you know, what happens to those people who want more work, but they can only get what they're getting? I think this is a bad idea on a number of levels. Now, a lot of this stuff's been held back by a Republican, a guy named Gene DiGirolamo, who has stood up and said, you know what? Whoa. 1030 is bad enough. 1030 does a whole bunch of bad stuff. Let's just leave it at that. We don't really need all this other stuff. We've given the chamber the majority of what they want. We've given the business community the majority of what they want. Let's leave it at that. And again, you know, I'm always amazed that the right seems to want to pander to business this much. Well, you were willing to give that much? We can get more. You were willing to give that much? We can get more. We can get more and more and more because it's there. And I'm just fascinated at the way this whole thing works, where they have no real conscience. I mean, that's what it comes down to. No real conscience. And the other screw job we'll talk about a little bit later in the program is this workers' comp bill. Basically, 95% of the people in the state of Pennsylvania who get injured on the job will never see their own doctor. Never, ever, ever. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people at the time.
The Rick Smith Show.
You've reached Jenny in the Accounts Receivable Department of Dent Supply International. I can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message and I'll return your call as soon as I'm available.
Jenny was in constant pain and missing too much work.
I wasn't reliable. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't be what I wanted to be. I knew that I could do my job better. I knew that I could be a better mom. I could be a better wife. But my body wasn't letting me.
Fortunately, Jenny's employer has Capital Blue Cross. And Capital gave Jenny a whole set of services called Better Health Works. Jenny filled out a profile, got online coaching, and called a nurse line.
She talked me out of a very dark time because I didn't know what else to do. Since I had my surgery, now I can give my employer and my family 110% of me.
Capital's Amy Montgomery is happy that Jenny is happy.
It feels great that Capital Blue Cross was able to help Jenny this way.
We really believe in what we do, and I think that that's one of the things that makes us successful. I think it's a perfect example of when you care more, you do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed. At least we're all in it together.
together.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, in November, the Republicans ran on that platform of jobs, jobs, jobs. The day after the election, it kind of switched to we need to give more money to rich people. We need to make sure that they're taken care of, and no jobs message. And then it was right back to the same divisive, failed policies that have been going on for 30 years. We need to go after abortion. We need to go after those divisive wedge issues. And now, let's kill Social Security. Let's kill Medicare. Let's get rid of that Medicaid. How dare we have to pay for those people, you know, those people who paid into that system all their life. It's really amazing that we let them get away with it. Just amazing. And the jobs thing to me is most important. That's why I think we need to have a new jobs program, but well, we'll see. I've got Roger Hickey on the line from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. Roger, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, again, you know, after the November election, and I've been talking about this for the longest time, the Republicans hammered us, hammered the Democrats on jobs, hammered jobs, 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 and then the second they took control, where'd the jobs go?
Yeah, they started cutting everything that people care about in the budget. They started going after Social Security and Medicare, and they really are frauds. If they got their way, if this Ryan budget were to pass, for example, the whole economy would tank. But there's a lesson in that last election. The reason they were able to win was jobs, jobs, jobs.
Yep.
That's what the voters cared about. That's what the Democrats didn't have a message on, because President Obama, who I support, did not figure out that his economic program that he was able to get passed wasn't perfect, that he needed to warn the public that we might have to do more to get the economy going. And he ran with the message, or the Democrats ran with the message, be patient, it's all coming back, it's all going to be good, and people weren't feeling good. There's a real danger with the latest unemployment numbers that the Democrats could run that way again, leaving themselves open to the jobs, jobs, jobs campaign that Mitt Romney and others are already starting to run.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and you know, you look at those numbers, and I say that those numbers are Republican mission accomplished. What they've done is they've been able to convince people that we need to cut, cut, cut. Which means firing teachers, which means firing public service workers, which means basically destroying the entire public sector. And
raising the unemployment rate.
And raising the unemployment rate. And again, it's this self-fulfilling prophecy that they seem to, and I believe this is all their plan. I think they're masters at campaigning. I think they're masters at creating crisis, so that we have to start talking about cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, destroying Medicaid, things that, you know, 2 or 3 years ago I don't think would have even been near the table, let alone something we were considering.
And the irony is they're going to come back and run a jobs campaign against the Democrats again. They're going to say, where are the jobs? Obama's been in charge for 3 years. He hasn't produced a recovery. What it takes is for progressives and Democrats to stand up and say the Republican agenda of austerity and cuts is killing this economy.
Yep.
This is a weak economy. It's the absolutely wrong thing to be making these big cuts in public spending that people care about and need. And we need to challenge the Republicans to support a jobs bill. And the problem with the Democrats is if they can't pass something through the Congress, they don't want to talk about it.
Right. Yeah, and that's one of the things that drives me nuts. But you got to give the Republicans credit, and I do on a number of levels, that even though they know they're going to lose, and they're going to lose the Social Security and Medicare fight for right now,
yep,
but they've planted the seed for down the road.
Yep.
Where they know down the road, if you just keep hammering the message enough, you know, you might get people to come around to it.
And if the Democrats were to say, we have a jobs plan, it involves investing in infrastructure, it involves putting people back to work, and the Republicans won't support it, that would put the Republicans on the defensive for a change. Instead, the Democrats are saying, well, we're going to be a little bit softer than the Republicans on cuts. We're not going to be quite as bad. And they lose any kind of a jobs message whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, the jobs message should be pretty simple. The Republican plan is a failure. And the Republicans, again, Pawlenty came out with his plan the other day saying, well, what we need to do is we need to do some really, really important stuff, some revolutionary stuff, like cut taxes on corporations and deregulate, you know, revolutionary stuff that's never been tried before and has never been failing, has never failed
once
before.
Once again, that's what they always resort to, is cut taxes on the very wealthy and the corporations. And, of course, they blow a hole in the deficit and they're praised as being great deficit hawks. It doesn't do a thing for the working people of America who are desperately looking for decent jobs and economic growth.
But I keep asking, how do they get away with it? It's the same thing we've been hearing over and over. There's no new ideas here.
They get away with it until they're challenged. And here's the successful example. The president was going to give a speech in April talking about the deficit, and we were worried that he was going to give away Social Security and Medicare, so we had a massive email and phone calling campaign to the White House saying, tell the president, don't cut Medicare and Social Security. He made the speech. He said, I'm going to fight for Medicare. That allowed the contrast between the White House and the Ryan budget that was going through the House, passed by the House. When Republicans went home, they got our version of the Tea Party in their districts, asking them tough questions about why are you getting rid of Medicare? Why are you turning it into a voucher? We had educated the people about what they were about. And then the New York 26 congressional race played out with a good Democrat saying, I'm not going to go to Washington to cut Medicare. I'm going to stop the Ryan plan. And she won in a very Republican district.
Yep.
So when Democrats play on the offense and we don't give away half the store to the Republicans, we can win. And that's the lesson of we're trying to make sure that these negotiations in the White House don't cut Social Security, because that would muddle the issue.
Yeah, you know, and you brought the voucher thing again. And here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're talking about vouchering education, as they've been talking about for the last decade at least. And I wonder, what's this fascination with vouchers? I mean, we know that whatever they're going to give us is never going to be enough to cover what we need. But again, you know, I have this thought in my head. It's really not about you and me. It's about those doing very, very well, putting a little bit more in their pockets.
That's the way it works. They hate government, and they don't want to sign a check that says we're going to give people the education they need to be successful. Instead, they're going to say, just like on Medicare, we're going to give people one piece of paper that entitles you to so much money, and if you run out of that money, you're on your own.
Well, that is the conservative mantra. You're basically on your own. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Roger Hickey from the Campaign for America's Future. After all, it is Our Future Friday. Again, ourfuture.org is the website you want to check out. Lots of great information there. Lots of good stuff. You're going to have to cut that.
Bless you.
You know, why is it that the only budget we're talking about, why is it the only thing I keep hearing in the media is this Ryan budget? How come we haven't heard anything? I've heard virtually no talk of the people's budget, which does some really, really good things, and I think would take the country in a much more progressive direction and actually help us get out of the mess we're in.
The Progressive Caucus, members of Congress who put that together, they managed to get the deficit down just by getting rid of the Bush tax cuts and cutting the military budget and a little health reform. And they do it without rewarding the wealthy or cutting major programs. So it's just indicative of how blind the national media is. They have all these people on television saying, oh, well, Ryan may be unpopular, but that's the way we have to go. And we've launched a campaign called the American Majority Campaign that simply reminds all the media what the American people actually believe in terms of what the polls tell us. The American public doesn't want Medicare and Social Security cut. Instead, they'd like to see rolling back the tax cuts for the wealthy. They'd like to see cuts in the military budget. They'd like to bring our troops home from Afghanistan. And when you add it all up, the views of the American public are not reflected in the national media except for shows like yours.
Well, so, again, it comes down to who owns them.
It does, but it also comes down to who demands to be heard. We can take some lessons from the Tea Party. They were aggressive. They didn't take no for an answer. They went to their local media and said, we want you to have us on your shows, and did the same with the national media. So it's not unusual when you turn on CNN to see some Tea Party crackpot on those programs. We've got to do the same thing. Yep. We've got to say we represent the views of the vast majority of the American public, and if you're going to have Pete Peterson on a show talking about cutting Social Security, you've got to have somebody from our side. And we've got to demand that the American majority get represented in the mass media.
Yeah, whatever happened to fair and balanced?
Yeah, right.
I know it's a nice slogan, but not much in reality. And, you know, as I've been saying for the longest time, I do agree with some of the Republicans' views. I think we should stop borrowing money. I think we should be raising revenue, which means the people who are doing very, very well and did really well, $2.5 trillion handout Bush gave the top this country. Maybe we should ask them for a little help first.
You sound like an Eisenhower Republican. You know, back in the Eisenhower days, the rates on wealthy people were up in the 80% range.
Actually, in 1953, it was 92%.
There you go. It used to be the Republicans believed in financing the government in a prudent way. Now, they just, as you said before, they cut, it's starve the beast, and then they have to cut programs. So, I'd say bring back the old-fashioned Republican virtues of thrift and fiscal probity.
Yeah, you know, I often say the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. Because by the way we're looking at people today, he would be he'd almost be a communist.
Well,
because look at what he did.
He was a veteran of World War II when all Americans pulled together, not only to defeat fascism, but to rebuild our country. And he knew what it took, to mobilize a great nation. So, we should be taking some lessons from Eisenhower.
Absolutely. But, you know, he built the highway system with public money.
Yep.
I don't think we, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we have the ability in this country to tackle a problem that large. I think we're too divided.
Well, it's really time to talk about the greatness of this country again. It's really time to talk about can we do big things like get off of foreign oil and retool for green jobs. I think most young people really want to live in a great country.
Yep.
And most seniors, people who are part of that greatest generation, would cheer them on if they did that too.
And I'm right there with them. You know, at the end of this, it comes down to we need to honor our commitment to the past. Although the right keeps, you know, they keep pushing this way. You know, we need to, you know, it won't hurt those folks who are on Social Security if we cut those folks in the future. I think we honor the responsibilities that we have to this. We keep the tattered safety net that we have, maybe strengthen it and move forward. And, you know, the people who are doing very well, hey, you know what? Time for you to kick in. Remember that shared sacrifice thing?
Yeah. And, you know, people my age are starting to realize this is a self-interested issue. We don't have the kind of pensions that the last generation had. Social Security and Medicare are more important than ever for us in this kind of freelance kind of world that we live in. And so I think you're going to see a rousing defense of the things that we do together, like Social Security and Medicare, big success stories. Just like you saw in upstate New York in that election.
Yep.
The generations are coming together now because they know that this kind of investment is good for the country.
Absolutely. Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. I appreciate your time. Great talking to you, sir.
Great, and let me encourage all your folks to come to our October 3rd Take Back the American Dream Conference here in Washington. You can see it on our website.
We're hoping to be there as well, broadcasting from your conference. You guys always do a great job. We've been to the last couple, but great work you guys do there.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much, Rick. Roger. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Look at smart policy, and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. At a nurses' rally in Washington this week, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka repeated a warning to politicians that workers want a politically independent labor movement, and labor won't be supporting politicians who don't support workers. Trumka first sounded this warning at a National Press Club speech in May.
Powerful political forces are seeking to silence working people. Working people want a labor movement strong enough to help return balance to our economy, fairness to our tax system, security to our families, and moral and economic standing to our nation. And it doesn't matter if candidates and parties are controlling the wrecking ball or simply standing aside to let it happen. The outcome is the same either way to us. If leaders aren't blocking the wrecking ball and advancing working families' interests, then working people will not support them.
Trumka says AFL-CIO is redoing its entire political program, intent on supporting only politicians who support workers. The U.S. Labor Department is suing the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services Child Protective Services Division for not paying overtime to hundreds of its employees. The suit alleges that 800 current and former investigators and caseworkers were denied the payments which are required under federal labor law. The suit seeks more than $1 million in back wages plus damages. New York City public workers have been cleared of intentional work slowdown allegations, Jesse Russell reports.
Do you remember all of the hoopla last December surrounding a New York City councilman who alleged he had evidence of an intentional work slowdown during one of the winter's worst blizzards? Well, last Friday, a report was finally released essentially exonerating city workers of any perceived wrongdoing. The report filed by the New York City Department of Investigation found that there was no evidence of a slowdown and that Councilman Daniel Halloran had no actual evidence that such a slowdown actually happened. Halloran was unable to produce evidence that city employees really had told him they were obstructing snow cleanup. The report did have one benefit, as it showed the city where it could improve in the future. For example, nearly half of the snow chains on trucks broke, and some workers became stuck in drifts for as long as 12 hours. Halloran, for his part, issued a statement saying the investigation didn't result in any definite conclusion regarding his statements, and he touted the courage of his convictions to take on the city.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Missed any portion of the program? Remember, you can download it there at the website at therickSmithShow.com. There for your entertainment and enjoyment. Big surprise here, the economy and unemployment top the list of issues that most American voters are saying are the most important, according to a Gallup poll released today. You know, again, is this really something we should be polling? Is this a big surprise when you've got a good number of people who are unemployed, you got a good number of people who are underemployed? When you look at the fact that we've seen wages falling, we've seen the cost of benefits rising, is it any real surprise? Not for me, it's not. But, you know, they got to make it like it's big news. And in all demographics, every income level, every demographic, the economy, jobs, that's important. And that's where the Republicans were able to, back in November, were able to put their finger on the pulse. People were upset. The job recovery hadn't happened fast enough. And what did happen, people took their amnesiac and forgot that in September of 2008, we had a massive collapse where that took millions of jobs with it. We're slowly digging out of that collapse. But they took their amnesiac and they forgot how we got here. And the Republicans are really hoping that to be the case, that people will continue to take their amnesiac and be pliable in what the message is. Like they're trying to do with Afghanistan and Iraq, trying to push that on Obama, and a lot of the other stuff that they've now,
You know, amazingly, the Patriot Act, another one that they've kind of gone, well, you know, it's Obama's now, when for all these years they supported it. Just nuts. You're not going to want to miss Monday night's big debate on CNN. And this has got to have Fox losing their mind, because Fox was thrilled that they had the first big debate of the Republicans. Got to be honest, didn't watch it, don't know who was there, was of almost no consequence to me whatsoever, because I think it's dumb to have a debate this early with these, especially with these people. I mean, really, Romney, Bachman, Gingrich, I mean, there's a guy who's basically his entire staff left. He's almost running an SB1 type campaign now, where, you know, there's nobody there. I'm surprised he got a press release out. You know, he probably wrote it on the back of a napkin, like they have with their jobs program. But, you know, Romney, Bachman, and Gingrich are going to be there on Monday night, along with Tim Pawlenty, Ron Paul, Herman Cain, and Rick Santorum. It's going to be up in Manchester, New Hampshire, you know, kind of getting ready for the big primary, doing that whole push thing, trying to get your name out there. And I got to be honest, the characters in this cycle, for doing something like this, sitting in this chair, just comic gold. I mean, someone like Herman Cain he's a gift that keeps on giving. I hope he doesn't go anytime soon, because he is just fantastic. I think he'd be a horrible leader, but I think he's just fantastic as a comedy bit. So Monday night, 8 o'clock, CNN. It's not often I do a pitch for CNN, but, I think it's worth taking a look at these. These are the people who want to be the next president of the United States. It scares me. I think I'd rather vote for Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. But, you know, that's a whole different ballgame. The big news today also, Sarah Palin's emails when she was governor, which, you know, she wasn't there very long. How many emails could she possibly have? Turns out 24,199 pages of her emails while she was governor are now available. You got to pay for them, and it's a lot of money. They're only going to print them out. You got to pay for the printing cost, and they're going to ship them. You got to pay for the shipping. I think the shipping was like $800 or something, and the printing costs were $700-$800. She's looking at $1,500 to get a whole bunch of emails that they scrubbed before they printed. Look, anything of any real import is going to be well scrubbed. This is still her state. There are still people there who like her, don't want the state to be embarrassed, don't want her to be embarrassed. I will be amazed if anything of any consequence comes out of this more than 24,000 pages of emails, but there'll be a couple people who go through it. And I'm interested to see what happens. To me, personally, I don't know why they have to print them out. Maybe someone's brother-in-law owns a printing shop. I don't know. Maybe this is one of those moments where you go, hey, here's a chance to create some jobs and get somebody else to pay for it. I don't know, but I think they should have all been put on the web. They should have been put on the internet for us to take a look at, you and I to search if we so choose. Personally, I don't really care about Sarah Palin. She, to me, is a non-entity. Not taking a part in the debate on Monday night. Not that she could find Manchester, New Hampshire, but again, I'm not. She's of no consequence whatsoever as far as I'm concerned. But that's a whole nother discussion. I'm interested to find out, though, what it is that is in these emails, because they already said that, you know, anything that we deemed, you know, that we deemed important to the state, we've already scrubbed. So we'll see. Also, Donald Trump is in the news. You know, he kind of threw his hat in, kind of not, kind of back, kind of in. I think the guy's got way too thin a skin, and I think even he knows that. I think after that press club dinner where he basically got roasted and wasn't expecting it, you could see the steam coming out of his ears. I think someone told him, hey, you know, you got to get out of this because you're just not it. But even he is realizing that the Republicans are making a big mistake in the Medicare system with this whole idea of wanting to replace Medicare with this voucher thing. And he's saying that the Republicans must have a death wish. He said, it almost seems to me as though the Republicans have a death wish. When they tamper with Medicare, which happens to be a good program, there's lots of fraud and waste and abuse, he says, which we should be taking care of. But when they tamper with Medicare, they have a death wish. And I agree. And I'm hoping that they continue please, by all means, keep your talk. Keep going after Medicare. Keep going after Granny. Keep going after Social Security. Programs that people want, programs that are good for society, keep doing that. Keep saying you want to profitize that. Keep saying you want to do that. Because at the end of the day, their plan is a failure. It's more a privatization scheme. It's more bad policy. It's good for their bottom line, though. Understand. It's good for putting money in their pocket because the investor class wants this, especially Social Security. If Wall Street could get their hands on Social Security, they'd be jumping for joy. Now, you and I, on the other hand, we'd be the ones struggling, suffering, and broke. Look what happened after the collapse of 2008. I really thought any discussion of putting the money from Social Security into Wall Street had stopped. Now, understand, I'm not against Wall Street. You want to invest, that's fine, but there are risks involved. Social Security is poverty insurance. This is an insurance program. This is to make sure that my grandmother does not fall below the poverty line, does not fall below a certain level, and that when I get to be that age, it will be there to make sure that I am not below a certain level. We've decided as a society, line in the sand, not going to happen, not going to have people living under bridges, not going to have people eating cat food, not going to happen. Republicans want to take us back to a time when that kind of stuff did happen. But here again, it's stuff that we've forgotten. We have forgotten our history, and we've forgotten this whole direction. So anyway, Gingrich back on the presidential path. Gingrich, most of his strategic staff, most of his staff left. And he's saying that it's for strategic purposes. They have strategic differences. It's not that they have anything to do with the policy. I think they realize the guy's nowhere. I think they realize because there's nothing there. He's basically screwed the pooch on every one of the mainstream Republican talking points. Going against the Ryan budget was almost a death wish. And they're making him pay for it. Now all of his advisors, all of his staff have said, we're jumping ship. We're going to abandon ship. So it was interesting. Even after his entire staff resigns, he gets a press release out. Like I said, it was probably on the back of a napkin. And now he's trying to change the subject a little bit. And what do you think he does to change the subject? What's the next logical position? Where would you go with this? The most easy position, go after Obama. Go after him. Call names, do whatever it is you need to do, but deflect. And they've done an amazing job of deflecting. They've done a really good job overall as a party. I don't know that Gingrich can do it. But he says, I am a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America because I think we are in the early stages of the Obama depression. Remember what I told you earlier? They've already begun to, Iraq, Afghanistan, that's Obama. Richard and Michael Steele said, Obama got us into Afghanistan. If you remember that a year or so ago. Also the Patriot Act, another thing that they're trying to saddle Obama with. And with their messaging machine, they may just get away with it. But anyway, Gingrich went out to say, I'm prepared to go out and to campaign very intensely, even if he doesn't have a staff. He says, but I want a campaign on ideas and on solutions. And I want to do it in a way that brings America together into a movement, a large movement. Personally, I'd like to know what Gingrich's response would be to Anthony Weiner's position. After all, I don't remember people calling for Gingrich's resignation after people found out about his affairs, especially given the fact that he was one of the lead people out there trying to go after Bill Clinton during his years. Kind of just one of those weird moments. Tricky Ricky Santorum back in the news. Tricky Ricky, a little angry about how some view his name on Google, and if you just, all I'm going to say is just Google Santorum. That's the only way I can do this without getting into FCC problems. But he was talking to Chuck Todd on TV the other day, and they were going back and forth. And what I thought was interesting about Santorum is he plays such a great angry victim. I mean, really, he looked angry, but he looked like he was ready to cry. So, kind of like an angry John Boehner. I mean, it was hysterical that, you know, he had this angry indignation. He was so ticked off. I thought he was going to break out into tears and you know, just plain nuts. But you know, this is a guy who I don't think stands a snowball's chance. He got thumped here in Pennsylvania. It makes no sense for him to go out on the national stage when you're not going to carry your own state. And I guess my question is Pennsylvania even his home state anymore? I mean, he runs around like it is, but as I understand, he lives in Virginia. If I remember the case right, he actually had to reimburse the Penn Hill School District for the cyber school that his children attended that the school district in Pennsylvania paid for in Virginia. That kind of tells me not a resident. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But Monday night should just be pure gold. Standing on the stage with Herman Cain and Santorum and Bachman. Oh, please. There's got to be, in Gingrich, you throw in Pawlenty and Romney, there's got to be some comic gold there that evening. And I hope I kind of hope they put Cain and Santorum together so that they can really hate. They can really homosexual hate together. They can be the two homophobes on the end. What would be great if they got the Republican who, right at the beginning said he was, you know, pro gay marriage and fairly liberal Republican. If they'd have put him, between the two of them, I wonder how that'd have worked out. But Herman Cain in the news, just like, Tricky Ricky, who said that he believes that gays and lesbians have a choice about their sexual preference. He believes it's a sin because it's a, you know, he's a Bible thumping Christian. And I go, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's a sin. A lot of stuff that, is not something promoted, you know, like wearing clothes of more than one fabric or touching the flesh of a dead pig or eating the pig. Yet I like bacon. And I gotta wonder, you know, I wonder how many of those things that Mr. Cain, does, how many of those things would be looked upon favorably in the Bible. Also, another possible entrance into the bid for the White House, former Republican representative Virgil Good. He's contemplating a run for the big house there. He was a 6-term congressman. He distinguished himself with openly bigoted rhetoric towards gays, immigrants, Muslims, and others in the minority community. So he should really fit in well. Should fit in well because, you know, that's been their positioning. And what I'm hoping they all continue along that path because that's a winning thing there. Keep going after Medicare. Keep ticking people off there. Keep going after Social Security. Keep bashing on the gay people because, you know, that's a good seller. Go after those Muslims and let's not forget the immigrants. So keep that line of hate, keep that going. And I'm hoping the American voter watches how this all works out because, amazingly enough, it's about jobs. And their jobs plan is nothing. Their jobs plan is the same as it has been. Lower taxes for the very wealthy, less regulations on corporations, and wish and hope. And wish and hope economics hasn't worked very well for us, has it? The idea that we're going to give away as much as we can and then wish and hope that something happens. Again, I wish we could go back, like we talked about with Scott Paul, go back to having a manufacturing plan. An energy plan would be nice. Nice to have some of these plans in place to move the country forward and begin to rebuild our economy and dig out of this massive hole that we've been put into thanks to the Bush administration and thanks to the Wall Street crowd, to the criminals here on Wall Street. I'm telling you, I'm looking forward to Monday night. I hope you watch it because I am not going to miss it. Pure radio gold. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show for working people.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
It's time for another Gooberhead Award, presented periodically to those in the news who have their tongues running 100 miles an hour but forgot to put their brains in gear. Today, I've got two goobers from last year's teabag uprising, both of whom got elected by promising to bring common sense to Congress and take government back from the special interests. Goober number one is Arizona's Ben Quayle, the son of Dan, and truly a flake off the old block. Ben has proven to be a stand-up guy, not for the folks, but for big oil. While voting to slash government programs to help the elderly and the poor, he has voted not once but twice to keep giving $2 billion in annual tax subsidies to the five richest oil corporations. In a town hall meeting back home, a feisty lady asked him why. Ben essentially called her ignorant, insisting that big oil was merely getting the same tax deductions that all corporations get. It's not specific to the oil industry, he said, to which the audience burst out laughing. They were right to guffaw, for tax giveaways called intangible drilling costs and enhanced oil recovery costs are obviously specific to that industry. Is Ben lying, or just a goober? Our second awardee is Sean Duffy of Wisconsin, who campaigned as a regular guy, but asked at a town hall gathering whether he'd vote to cut congressional pay as a symbolic stand with his hard-hit constituents, Sean fell into a paroxysm of self-pity. I have more debt than all of you, he wailed, adding that he can't even buy a new car on his $174,000 a year paycheck. And Duffy also complained about Congress's health and pension plans, most of which are paid for by us taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Sean, if it's such a burden being a Congress critter, quit and join the real world. What a goober.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Well, this week marked the historic anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the big tax handouts the Bush administration so generously bestowed upon the very wealthy in this country. Question is, how did it work out for you? Some of the numbers I've seen for every buck that I got, the folks at the top got something like 450. Not so much on the even distribution there. Not so much being left in or left out, as he said he was going to do. That's why I've asked Michael Linden, Director of Tax and Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress, to come talk to us about what the last 10 years has been like, who are the winners, losers, and what's it cost us? What have we lost because of it? Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I look at this 10 years, $2.5 trillion. What did we get for it?
A wrecked economy, growing income inequality, fewer jobs, and those are pretty much the top line. I can't really say anything good. There's really no silver lining here.
There's nothing good. You can't. I can come up with at least one thing that's good.
Okay, I'm interested.
I have a friend makes a very, very good living. He's in that top 2%. He got a very, very handsome tax break.
Yeah, and. But why is that good for the country?
Oh, no, it's just good for him.
Okay, sure. Well, in that case, you know, I can think of like a couple of 100,000 people who really like the Bush tax cuts. If that's our measure, you know, if there's one person in the country who's better off because of it, then sure. But if the country as a whole is better off, no. There's no plausible argument that the Bush tax cuts had any positive impact on the country at all. On every measure that we were promised, you know, this will create more jobs. Oh, this will create more economic growth. Oh, and by the way, there'll still be plenty of money left over to retire the national debt. Then on all of those measures, the Bush tax cuts are a colossal failure. Yeah. And there's really no argument about it.
Yeah, I mean, but it's the same, but we're going to have to relive that same period, though. Because I heard Pawlenty the other day, I heard Romney, they're all touting the same jobs program. We need to give rich people more money because their pockets aren't full enough yet for things to start spilling out for us to fight over.
Well, it just shows how bankrupt, and I use that word on purpose, their ideas really are. I mean, come up with something new. I mean, I would really be sad if the American people fell for, if we all, you know, fool me once kind of thing. You know, we fell for it 10 years ago, but we just lived through another experiment in so-called supply-side economics where we give rich people a lot of money and hope that it trickles down to everybody else, and we know it doesn't work. Now, come up with something new. I mean, please, at least for the sake of originality, come up with something new.
But here's the thing that the right's doing, I think, a fairly good job of doing. I mean, you look at the wars in Afghanistan, you look at the debt, you look at the crisis that we're in. They've actually done a pretty good job of spinning this around and making it all Obama's fault, like September of 2008 never happened. These big handouts never happened. And if you go back, you know, when Bush took office, we were on pace to paying off the debt. You had Alan Greenspan going, we don't know what's going to happen if we pay the debt off too fast. We have no idea. And he was actually saying he was actually worried.
Yeah, I mean, we need to remember that even before the fall of 2008, even before the start of the Great Recession, the Bush tax cuts had already failed. And the job creation numbers during the five so-called good years of the, you know, moderately good years of the Bush economic growth period were paled in comparison to the same years under Clinton. Same thing with economic growth. And of course, we all know what happened to the national debt. So it's just, even if you take out the colossal effect that the recession has had on the economy, the Bush tax cuts still failed. There is no two ways about it. Conservative economists have to twist themselves in ridiculous knots to try and come up with a plausible, semi-plausible scenario under which the Bush tax cuts were not a complete and utter failure.
I think they were. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Michael Linden, Director of Tax and Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. We've got a link to their, on our site at TheRickSmithShow.com to his writing, to Michael's writing, some really good stuff. You know, you look at this, and for me, it's the lost opportunities. What could we have done with all of that money? What could we have done for our children? What could we have done for our infrastructure? What kind of job creation could have happened had we decided that, you know, we're gonna pursue an energy policy that's gonna get us off the juice? What if?
Yeah, it's kind of painful to do that exercise because it's of all the lost opportunities. I mean, in the economics profession, we call that an opportunity cost, right? Instead of putting that money to something that would have grown or paid off, paid dividends in the future, we gave it to people who didn't need it, and it didn't have any dividends, didn't have any payoff. But I will say this, you know, narrow the question just down to one issue. Let's just talk about the national debt for a second. There were a lot of things that happened over the past 10 years that really contributed to the growth in national debt. The fighting two wars, paying for, instituting a new domestic spending program, Medicare Part D, without paying for it. The recession, of course, has been a huge impact. But even if with all those same things, even if all that had happened, if we had just not passed the Bush tax cuts, we would have sustainable debt levels right now. Nobody would be talking about, oh, the debt's too big, we got to worry about the debt. So yes, we had a lot of trouble the past 10 years in terms of fiscal matters for a lot of different reasons, some avoidable, some not. But the Bush tax cuts are the prime reason that we are sitting here today even discussing the words debt and deficit.
Yeah, I agree. You know, here's the thing. I'm maybe a little more cynical than you are. Maybe not. Maybe you'll agree with me. But I look at this and I say this is another example of Republicans creating a crisis, deliberately doing what I think they've done for their end game, which was to destroy what's left of the social safety net in this country. Do away with Social Security, do away with Medicare, do away with Medicaid, things that they have been against from their inception.
Well, I don't think that's cynical. I mean, it's just taking them at their word. They've been very, very conservative, politicians and thinkers, using that word loosely, have been very honest about wanting to quote unquote drown the, you know, shrink government down to the size they can drown it in a bathtub. That they're talking about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. That's what they're talking about. And so it's not cynical to say that this is their game plan. Cut revenue, cut revenue, cut revenue, especially for people at the top. And then you know, say, oh my gosh, we have all this debt. Where did it come from? I don't know. I guess we got to cut Social Security and Medicare. If anybody's being cynical, it's conservatives. You know, at least they should just come right out and say, look, we don't believe that there should be a social safety net. We don't believe that the government should have any role in guaranteeing a safe and secure retirement. And that's why we're against these things. Instead, they come out with these ridiculous contortions where they say that voucherizing Medicare will actually save it, you know, and privatizing Social Security will actually protect it. That's what's cynical.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, you brought up the honesty point there. And Grover Norquist, one of the leaders of the, what I say, the anti-American movement, he was quite honest about it when he said this.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
And here's a guy, been the leader of tax policy in this country and here in this state. We've got a governor here in Pennsylvania who has taken his bizarre, insane anti-tax pledge. When everybody in the state says tax the drillers, all the legislature wants to tax the drillers, the drilling industry wants to be taxed. But because Corbett took this bizarre anti-tax pledge, no tax is going to happen.
Yeah, that particular movement, this anti-tax crusade, is so maddening to me. Just for a second, step back and imagine if Democrats around the country signed a pledge to never cut spending. Even if there was a program that was stupid and didn't work, we would never, you know, nobody would ever cut it because we signed this pledge, so, you know, quote unquote. So people would deride them for being ridiculous and just bad policy,
yep.
And rightly so, because if something's not working, you shouldn't do it anymore. But that's exactly what Republicans have done all over the country. They signed this ridiculous pledge that says, under no circumstances, not wars, not emergencies, not huge mounting debt, not even if a policy is just plain dumb, we are always going to support it as long as it's a tax cut.
Yep. And what's interesting to me is you're seeing presidential candidates on the Republican side. First Romney, who came out and said, we're going to cap spending. We're going to cap it at 20%. And then Pallente couldn't be outdone by Romney. No, 18%. But none of them are talking about revenue.
No, they are talking about revenue. I mean, you know, Governor Pallente talked about revenue. He's just talking about cutting it. He's saying his plan is to cut taxes for millionaires by 41% and to reduce government revenue down to under 14% of GDP. That is the lowest in post-war history. That's lower than it is now, and we're already at a low point in post-war history. And that would create even more debt, even with his ridiculous pledge to cap spending at 18% of GDP. And let me just say one thing about these pledges to cap spending. People should hear that for what it actually is. The only way, and I'm going to say it twice, the only way to get spending down to 18% of GDP as our population ages is to get rid of Medicare and Social Security. You can't do it any other way. And so when you hear those kinds of caps, that is just code for voucherizing Medicare, privatizing Social Security, and block granting Medicaid. That is it. There's no other way to do it. Unless, of course, you're willing to abolish the Pentagon, which I don't want to do, and neither do they.
In fact, they've said, and I've heard Pallente say it, you know, we're not cutting the Pentagon. In fact, we should strengthen it. Strengthen it.
Right. That's right. Under Governor Pallente's plan, the Pentagon would become would be more than a third of all non-interest spending. So that's pretty much what he thinks the federal government should do.
I think it was you who did the labor on this. In looking at the Bush tax cuts and comparing it to Romney's, tax plan and the spending plan, I think you said something like $7.8 trillion in additional debt over the next 10 years?
Yeah, this is Governor Pallente's plan is to impose tax cuts on top of the Bush tax cuts that are three times as large as the Bush tax cuts. His answer for it is, oh, we'll just get incredible economic growth, you know, and that's just magical thinking, and it's just nonsense. And if you hear me getting worked up, it's because I am worked up. It would be different if we could have a really adult conversation. Yes, marginal tax rates matter. I will concede that. If they get too high, they really will discourage people from working. But we are at 35% at the top marginal rate. That's the lowest it's been. That's one of the lowest places it's been in American history. And we're talking about reducing it even further. It doesn't make any sense to me. And instead of having a rational conversation about what good tax policy should be. Should we be giving tax subsidies to oil and gas companies when they clearly don't need them? Instead, we have this ridiculous anti-tax, you know, sort of crusade that just just pushes all rational discussion to the side, and instead you get plans like Governor Pawlenty's, who just says, you know, oh, don't tax capital gains at all.
Well, so those hedge fund managers who are making $1 billion,
right,
making bets, they pay no tax. Is what he?
They pay no tax. That's his plan. Zero tax, not a little bit. They already pay an incredibly low rate, 15%. Governor Pawlenty's plan is zero, just nothing. And when they die, if they want to pass on that estate they've never paid tax on, worth billions and billions of dollars to their heirs, they also would pay no tax on that. So what we're just doing is creating an aristocracy. That's all that would do.
You brought up marginal tax rates there for a second, and I always like to go back to the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower, who had a top marginal rate of 92% at one point. And I always ask the question, did we not have rich people back then? Did we not have people who worked in that strata? Didn't they work? Did they just stop? Or did they not exist?
No, I mean, they did. I mean, look, the tax code was different back then. There's no question about it. And I don't think anybody is really seriously suggesting that we go back to the rates that we had in the 1950s. If we did, they'd sort of get laughed out of the room. But here's the problem. Conservatives are suggesting that we go back to the same sort of size of government and functions of government that we had before World War II. And they should be laughed out of the room for the exact same reasons. The country has changed. Things are different. We've learned a lot over the past 60 years about what is good public policy. We've learned that it's not appropriate public policy in a modern, rich country like ours to have one out of every three senior citizens living in poverty. We don't want to do that anymore. And we address that issue by having a robust Social Security system and Medicare and Medicaid. And now conservatives are saying, yeah, that's, you know, yeah, that worked great, I guess, but we're going to get rid of it. They should be laughed out of the room for even mentioning it.
Yeah, I agree. But here's the thing. You know, instead of borrowing more money, and this was one of my big knocks, you know, about the recovery plan back in 2009, and maybe you'll correct me here, but, you know, instead of borrowing a boatload of money, why didn't we just raise taxes on the folks who had done very well under the Bush plan and pay for it instead of borrowing, saying, look, times are tough, shared sacrifice, because we keep hearing about all this shared sacrifice, yet I'm not seeing any sharing.
No, that's doing it too. The shared sacrifice point is disingenuous, because when people say shared sacrifice, they mean everybody except for the rich. But I do want to correct you on this. I would not share that criticism of the Recovery Act. In the midst of the greatest drop in economic activity in post-war history, you don't want to really raise taxes on anybody, even on people who can afford it. Now, we're out of that at this point. The people who are suffering right now, the people who are still holding back on their consumer spending, who are still trying desperately to pay off household debt, they are not the people at the very top. There is no good reason why we couldn't raise some revenue off of people at the very, very top right now to help us pay down the debt. The fact is that the Recovery Act is actually a very minor factor in our current debt troubles. If you look at the projections going forward, even if you look at right now, it's an incredibly minor factor, especially when you compare it to things like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Bush tax cuts, and just the larger effect of the Great Recession, which had an enormous, enormous effect on the debt by dropping revenue, even without the tax cuts, down to extremely low levels. So, you know, I wouldn't criticize the Recovery Act for that. Going forward, however, it has to be part of the solution to the debt problem to raise more revenue from the people who can most afford it and who have benefited the most over the past 10 years. The middle class has really taken a beating over the past 10 years. They were the ones who didn't get a real pay raise since the late 90s. They're the ones who are forced to work longer hours, longer into their lifespan because their retirement funds have went down. They are the ones who are really, really suffering. The wealthy, however, they've recovered. They took a small, they took a hit during the recession. Everybody did, but they're back. They're back and better than ever.
There's a little blip on the radar. You know, last question I've got for you, you know, as we're looking at budgets, you know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, you're talking about cutting $1 billion from education. You know, before we start going down that path, seeing our education system crumble like our infrastructure has crumbled, I say what we have to be doing is going after those folks who have done very well before we start cutting our kids' future. And that's just the bottom line here, but I'm not seeing that anywhere in the debate. I have seen no one talking about the Progressive Caucus's people's budget. It's all cut, and nothing else.
Yeah, it's true that the debate really has moved off of where I would wish it was. But I will say that I actually don't consider asking people at the very top to pay more, going after them. You know, they have benefited enormously from living in this country, from the system of government, from all the protections that this country offers to people who have. And asking them to pay a little bit more so that we can continue that system, so that we don't go back to a pre-modern era, that's to their benefit too. It's an investment. It's an investment for all of us. Education, transportation, science, energy, those things pay off for everybody, especially for people at the very top. So look, it's not going after them. It's not punishing them. It's simply saying, listen, you guys have done very well, and if you want to continue to keep doing very well, we have to protect the system that we have. And that means investing. That means fixing bridges. That means good schools. That means, you know, making sure that we're still the leader in innovation. And that means a little bit more taxes from you. And I don't think that's too much to ask, and it's certainly not punitive by any measure.
I absolutely agree. Michael Linden, I appreciate your time. Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. He's got a great piece, The Bush Tax Cuts Are the Disaster That Keeps on Giving. You can check that out on our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Michael Linden's name. Michael, thanks so much. Always great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Millions in this country don't have a damn to spare. Multi-millions in this country get not a damn to spare.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Missed any portion of the program, remember, you can download it there at the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. There for your entertainment and enjoyment. Big surprise here, the economy and unemployment top the list of issues that most American voters are saying are the most important, according to a Gallup poll released today. You know, again, is this really something we should be polling? Is this a big surprise when you've got a good number of people who are unemployed, you got a good number of people who are underemployed? When you look at the fact that we've seen wages falling, we've seen the cost of benefits rising, is it any real surprise? Not for me, it's not. But, you know, they got to make it like it's big news. And in all demographics, every income level, every demographic, the economy, jobs, that's important. And that's where the Republicans were able to, back in November, were able to put their finger on the pulse. People were upset. The job recovery hadn't happened fast enough. And what did happen, people took their amnesiac and forgot that in September of 2008 we had a massive collapse where that took millions of jobs with it. We're slowly digging out of that collapse. But they took their amnesiac and they forgot how we got here. And the Republicans are really hoping that to be the case, that people will continue to take their amnesiac and be pliable in what the message is. Like they're trying to do with Afghanistan and Iraq, trying to push that on Obama, and a lot of the other stuff that they've now, you know, amazingly, the Patriot Act, another one that they've kind of gone, well, you know, it's Obama's now, when for all these years they supported it. Just nuts. You're not going to want to miss Monday night's big debate on CNN. And this has got to have Fox losing their mind, because Fox was thrilled that they had the first big debate of the Republicans. Got to be honest, didn't watch it, don't know who was there, was of almost no consequence to me whatsoever, because I think it's dumb to have a debate this early with these, especially with these people. I mean, really, Romney, Bachman, Gingrich, I mean, there's a guy who's basically his entire staff left. He's almost running an SB1 type campaign now, where, you know, there's nobody there. I'm surprised he got a press release out. You know, he probably wrote it on the back of a napkin, like they have with their jobs program. But, you know, Romney, Bachman, and Gingrich are going to be there on Monday night, along with Tim Pawlenty, Ron Paul, Herman Cain, and Rick Santorum. It's going to be up in Manchester, New Hampshire, you know, kind of getting ready for the big primary, doing that whole push thing, trying to get your name out there. And I got to be honest, the characters in this cycle, for doing something like this, sitting in this chair, just comic gold. I mean, someone like Herman Cain he's a gift that keeps on giving. I hope he doesn't go anytime soon, because he is just fantastic. I think he'd be a horrible leader, but I think he's just fantastic as a comedy bit. So Monday night, 8 o'clock, CNN. It's not often I do a pitch for CNN, but I think it's worth taking a look at. These are the people who want to be the next president of the United States. It scares me. I think I'd rather vote for Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. But you know, that's a whole different ballgame. The big news today also. Sarah Palin's emails when she was governor, which, you know, she wasn't there very long. How many emails could she possibly have? Turns out 24,199 pages of her emails while she was governor are now available. You got to pay for them, and it's a lot of money. They're only going to print them out. You got to pay for the printing costs, and they're going to ship them. You got to pay for the shipping. I think the shipping was like 800 bucks or something. And the printing costs were $700-$800. She's only going to have $1,500 to get a whole bunch of emails that they scrubbed before they printed. Look, anything of any real import is going to be well scrubbed. This is still her state. There are still people there who like her, don't want the state to be embarrassed, don't want her to be embarrassed. I will be amazed if anything of any consequence comes out of this more than 24,000 pages of emails. But there'll be a couple people who go through it. And I'm interested to see what happens. To me, personally, I don't know why they have to print them out. Maybe someone's brother-in-law owns a printing shop. I don't know. Maybe this is one of those moments where you go, hey, here's a chance to create some jobs and get somebody else to pay for it. I don't know. But I think they should have all been put on the web. They should have been put on the Internet for us to take a look at, you and I to search if we so choose. Personally, I don't really care about Sarah Palin. She, to me, is a non-entity. Not taking a part in the debate on Monday night. Not that she could find Manchester, New Hampshire, but again, I'm not. She's of no consequence whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned. But that's a whole other discussion. I'm interested to find out, though, what it is that is in these emails, because they already said that, you know, anything that we deemed, you know, that we deemed important to the state, we've already scrubbed. So we'll see. Also, Donald Trump is in the news. You know, he kind of threw his hat in, kind of not, kind of back, kind of in. I think the guy's got way too thin a skin. And I think even he knows that. I think after that press club dinner where he basically got roasted and wasn't expecting it, you could see the steam coming out of his ears. I think someone told him, hey, you know, you got to get out of this because you're just not it. But he is realizing that the Republicans are making a big mistake in the Medicare system with this whole idea of wanting to replace Medicare with this voucher thing. And he's saying that the Republicans must have a death wish. He said it almost seems to me as though the Republicans have a death wish. When they tamper with Medicare, which happens to be a good program, there's lots of fraud and waste and abuse, he says, which we should be taking care of. But when they tamper with Medicare, they have a death wish. And I agree. And I'm hoping that they continue. Please, by all means, keep your talk. Keep going after Medicare. Keep going after Granny. Keep going after Social Security. Programs that people want. Programs that are good for society. Keep doing that. Keep saying you want to profitize that. Keep saying you want to do that. Because at the end of the day, their plan is a failure. It's more a privatization scheme. It's more bad policy. It's good for their bottom line, though. Understand. It's good for putting money in their pocket because the investor class wants this, especially Social Security. If Wall Street could get their hands on Social Security, they'd be jumping for joy. Now, you and I, on the other hand, we'd be the ones struggling, suffering, and broke. Look what happened after the collapse of 2008. I really thought any discussion of putting the money from Social Security into Wall Street had stopped. Now, understand, I'm not against Wall Street. You want to invest, that's fine, but there are risks involved. Social Security is poverty insurance. This is an insurance program. This is to make sure that my grandmother does not fall below the poverty line, does not fall below a certain level, and that when I get to be that age, it will be there to make sure that I am not below a certain level. We've decided as a society, line in the sand, not going to happen, not going to have people living under bridges, not going to have people eating cat food, not going to happen. Republicans want to take us back to a time when that kind of stuff did happen. But here again, it's stuff that we've forgotten. We have forgotten our history, and we've forgotten this whole direction. So anyway, Gingrich back on the presidential path. Gingrich, most of his strategic staff, most of his staff left. And he's saying that it's for strategic purposes. They have strategic differences. It's not that they have anything to do with the policy. I think they realize the guy's nowhere. I think they realize because there's nothing there. He's basically screwed the pooch on every one of the mainstream Republican talking points. Going against the Ryan budget was almost a death wish. And they're making him pay for it. Now all of his advisors, all of his staff have said, we're jumping ship. We're going to abandon ship. So it was interesting. Even after his entire staff resigns, he gets a press release out. Like I said, it was probably on the back of a napkin. And now he's trying to change the subject a little bit. And what do you think he does to change the subject? What's the next logical position? Where would you go with this? The most easy position, go after Obama. Go after destroying, go after him. Call names, do whatever it is you need to do, but deflect. And they've done an amazing job of deflecting. They've done a really good job overall as a party. I don't know that Gingrich can do it. But he says, I am a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America because I think we are in the early stages of the Obama depression. Remember what I told you earlier? They've already begun to, Iraq, Afghanistan, that's Obama. Richard and Michael Steele said, Obama got us into Afghanistan. If you remember that a year or so ago. Also the Patriot Act, another thing that they're trying to saddle Obama with. And with their messaging machine, they may just get away with it. But anyway, Gingrich went out to say, I am prepared to go out and to campaign very intensely, even if he doesn't have a staff. He says, but I want a campaign on ideas and on solutions. And I want to do it in a way that brings America together into a movement, a large movement. Personally, I'd like to know what Gingrich's response would be to Anthony Weiner's position. After all, I don't remember people calling for Gingrich's resignation after people found out about his affairs, especially given the fact that he was one of the lead people out there trying to go after Bill Clinton during his years. Kind of just one of those weird moments. Tricky Ricky Santorum back in the news. Tricky Ricky, a little angry about how some view his name on Google, and if you just, all I'm going to say is just Google Santorum. That's the only way I can do this without getting into FCC problems. But he was talking to Chuck Todd on TV the other day, and they were going back and forth. And what I thought was interesting about Santorum is he plays such a great angry victim. I mean, really, he looked angry, but he looked like he was ready to cry. So, kind of like an angry John Boehner. I mean, it was hysterical that, you know, he had this angry indignation. He was so ticked off. I really did. I thought he was going to break out into tears and you know, just plain nuts. But you know, this is a guy who I don't think stands a snowball's chance. He got thumped here in Pennsylvania. It makes no sense for him to go out on the national stage when you're not going to carry your own state. And I guess my question is Pennsylvania even his home state anymore? I mean, he runs around like it is, but as I understand, he lives in Virginia. If I remember the case right, he actually had to reimburse the Penn Hill School District for the cyber school that his children attended that the school district in Pennsylvania paid for in Virginia. That kind of tells me not a resident. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But Monday night should just be pure gold. Standing on the stage with Herman Cain and Santorum and Bachman. Oh, please. There's got to be. And Gingrich, you throw in Pawlenty and Romney. There's got to be some comic gold there that evening. And I hope I kind of hope they put Cain and Santorum together so they can really hate. They can really homosexual hate together. They can be the two homophobes on the end. What would be great if they got the Republican who, right at the beginning said he was, you know, pro gay marriage and fairly liberal Republican. If they'd have put him, between the two of them, I wonder how that'd have worked out. But Herman Cain in the news, just like, Tricky Ricky, who said that he believes that gays and lesbians have a choice about their sexual preference. And he believes it's a sin because it's a, you know, he's a Bible-thumping Christian. And I go, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's a sin. A lot of stuff that is not something promoted. You know, like wearing clothes of more than one fabric or touching the flesh of a dead pig or eating the pig. Yet I like bacon. And I gotta wonder, you know, I wonder how many of those things that Mr. Cain, does, how many of those things would be looked upon favorably in the Bible. Also another possible entrance into the bid for the White House, former Republican representative Virgil Good. He's contemplating a run for the big house there. He was a six-term congressman. He distinguished himself with openly bigoted rhetoric towards gays, immigrants, Muslims, and others in the minority community. So he should really fit in well. Should fit in well because, you know, that's been their positioning. And what I'm hoping they all continue along that path because that's a winning thing there. Keep going after Medicare. Keep ticking people off there. Keep going after Social Security. Keep bashing on the gay people because, you know, that's a good seller. Go after those Muslims and let's not forget the immigrants. So keep that line of hate, keep that going. And I'm hoping the American voter watches how this all works out because, amazingly enough, it's about jobs. And their jobs plan is nothing. Their jobs plan is the same as it has been. Lower taxes for the very wealthy, less regulations on corporations, and wish and hope. And wish and hope economics hasn't worked very well for us, has it? The idea that we're going to give away as much as we can and then wish and hope that something happens. Again, I wish we could go back, like we talked about with Scott Paul, go back to having a manufacturing plan. An energy plan would be nice. Nice to have some of these plans in place to move the country forward and begin to rebuild our economy and dig out of this massive hole that we've been put into thanks to the Bush administration and thanks to the Wall Street crowd, to the criminals here on Wall Street. I'm telling you, I'm looking forward to Monday night. I hope you watch it because I am not going to miss it. Pure radio gold. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have your time.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. At a nurses' rally in Washington this week, AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka repeated a warning to politicians that workers want a politically independent labor movement, and labor won't be supporting politicians who don't support workers. Trumka first sounded this warning at a National Press Club speech in May.
Powerful political forces are seeking to silence working people. Working people want a labor movement strong enough to help return balance to our economy, fairness to our tax system, security to our families, and moral and economic standing to our nation. And it doesn't matter if candidates and parties are controlling the wrecking ball or simply standing aside to let it happen. The outcome is the same either way to us. If leaders aren't blocking the wrecking ball and advancing working families' interests, then working people will not support them.
Trumka says AFL-CIO is redoing its entire political program, intent on supporting only politicians who support workers. The U.S. Labor Department is suing the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services Child Protective Services Division for not paying overtime to hundreds of its employees. The suit alleges that 800 current and former investigators and caseworkers were denied the payments which are required under federal labor law. The suit seeks more than $1 million in back wages plus damages. New York City public workers have been cleared of intentional work slowdown allegations, Jesse Russell reports.
Do you remember all of the hoopla last December surrounding a New York City councilman who alleged he had evidence of an intentional work slowdown during one of the winter's worst blizzards? Well, last Friday, a report was finally released essentially exonerating city workers of any perceived wrongdoing. The report filed by the New York City Department of Investigation found that there was no evidence of a slowdown and that Councilman Daniel Halloran had no actual evidence that such a slowdown actually happened. Halloran was unable to produce evidence that city employees really had told him they were obstructing snow cleanup. The report did have one benefit, as it showed the city where it could improve in the future. For example, nearly half of the snow chains on trucks broke, and some workers became stuck in drifts for as long as 12 hours. Halloran, for his part, issued a statement saying the investigation didn't result in any definite conclusion regarding his statements, and he touted the courage of his convictions to take on the city.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday, Mitch McConnell and Orrin Hatch are out there slamming the president for having what they're calling a schizophrenic trade policy, doing more of this, pushing Obama into pushing these more of these NAFTA-like trade agreements with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. And yesterday, McConnell said that, you know, at a time when 14 million Americans are looking for work, they actually want to hold off these known job-creating agreements in exchange for a green light to spend more money. You know, by taking care of those workers who are going to be displaced by these insane trade agreements. It's just, it's like we've We've really fallen into the rabbit hole. Anyway, our next guest wrote a really thoughtful, good piece on the Columbia, on these trade agreements. His name's Dan Kovalik. He's a labor and human rights attorney out there in Pittsburgh. Dan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
You know, I look at this, and again, you know, the Republicans ramming these trade agreements through with the help of some Democrats, but it's going to cost us jobs, a lot of them, I think.
Yes. Well, at least one study I saw said that minimally it would cost 55,000 jobs. So instead of creating them, it's most likely going to cost us some.
So, you know, I look at this agreement, especially with Columbia, for me anyway, and I go, you know, we keep hearing this push for we need to be more business-friendly, and the first thing that pops into my mind is how much more business-friendly do we have to be? Do we have to be like Columbia where they take union leaders up in planes and throw them out or pull them off of buses and shoot them in the head?
Well, exactly. And, in fact, just I woke up this morning to see the annual report from the International Trade Union Confederation that monitors anti-union violence, and they concluded, as they have year after year for many years, that Colombia again has retained its spot as the number one most dangerous country in the world for trade unionists, with 51 union leaders killed last year in that country. And what's amazing is, in the entire world, Colombia accounts for over half of the killings of unionists in the entire world, and it only has 44 million people. So it's quite stunning. And as you say, what more could we do for companies than give them a license to kill union leaders? And in fact, one thing I allude to, and which has been given a lot of press, is that Chiquita Bananas, based in Cincinnati, Ohio, actually admitted to paying these paramilitary groups in Colombia $1.7 million and providing them with 3,000 Kalashnikov rifles. And as a result, about 4,000 civilians were killed. So these companies are literally sponsoring death squad activities in Colombia. So as you say, what else can we do? How much more free can we make these companies?
Yeah, it's just amazing to me. And, you know, I stop and I think about it. Is it 51 millionaires and billionaires were killed in Colombia? Would we be so, 51 CEOs, 54 corporate executives, would we be so willing to rush in there and push these agreements?
Well, precisely. And in fact, as we've pointed out on several occasions, in 2008, when President Obama was actually running for president, in his third debate with John McCain, he made it clear he opposed the free trade agreement with Colombia because, one, trade unionists were being killed in that country, and, two, the Colombian government was doing nothing to stop it. And the year he made that pronouncement, 52 unionists were killed there. So you have essentially the same union killing rate for last year, and yet now there is this push to get the free trade agreement passed, which is very disconcerting. And in fact, the AFL-CIO next week is bringing in about a half dozen union leaders from Colombia to lobby on Capitol Hill against the free trade agreement.
You know, and I look at that and I go, you know, are these the kind of countries, are these the people that we want to be trading partners with? Is this the direction as a country we want to go? Because if you're competing with them, with a country like Colombia, like China, you yourself have to either go down to their level or you have to figure out how to raise them up. But as we've learned from NAFTA, we've done not a very good job of raising that country up. In fact, what we've done is we've gone down toward their level.
Well, exactly. And NAFTA is a great example, which was, it turns out very few people would disagree with the premise that NAFTA was disastrous for both Mexico and the U.S. As the labor movement here predicted, hundreds of thousands of jobs here were lost due to NAFTA, and frankly, without little benefit to Mexico. In fact, the jobs they got were low-paying and associated with terrible working conditions. And even worse, the agricultural provisions that were part of NAFTA and that would also be part of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement devastated Mexico. It allowed the U.S. to send in subsidized food duty-free, and it wiped out about 1.3 million small farmers. And really, it is that policy which has led to this massive problem in terms of drugs and violence in Mexico, because these small farmers lost their land, and livelihood due to those policies, and essentially were pushed into illicit activities to survive. And so we know now that from those types of policies that both countries suffer greatly from free, so-called free trade.
Yeah, and we're full head of steam, right down the same failed path. But the good thing, I guess, is we're making good time at it. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dan Kovalika, a labor and human rights attorney in Pittsburgh. He's written a great piece. The killing continues as U.S. doubles down on failed trade policies. There's a link at our site at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Dan Kovalik's name. You know, you brought up the small farmer, and it's interesting that most people don't realize it. In order to pass NAFTA, the Mexican government actually had to change their constitution to steal land away from communities that they used for farming to feed the communities so that our agribusiness could come in and destroy them. And that, to me, again, one of those things that pushed the immigration issue here in this country as those people were thrown off their land, moved toward the maquiladoras where our U.S. businesses were going, and there wasn't enough, so they just kept coming right on into here.
Well, in fact, that's true. While small farmers make up a fairly small percentage of the Mexican population, 40% of those trying to immigrate here from Mexico are small farmers, because those are the people who were devastated.
Yep.
And so when people throw their hands up in the air concerned about immigration, for example, people have to realize it's our policies that really are feeding the desire to immigrate here, because we've destroyed the ability of people in their own countries to earn a livelihood. And in fact, an interesting thing last year, before the Senate, Bill Clinton, who frankly was one of the authors of the modern free trade agreements, including NAFTA, he apologized to the Senate, saying that his food policies in Haiti, which mirror those in, under NAFTA and would mirror those in if the Colombia Free Trade Agreement is passed, he said that his policies in Haiti destroyed their ability to feed themselves. And he said, I have to live with that every day. I did that. And he then said, interestingly, he said, these policies have never worked anywhere they've been tried. And yet, even with that admission, our government continues to push those failed policies.
Well, again, the question is, you know, you look at NAFTA and you said that, you know, both countries lost. Well, then who did benefit? And I say this, these agreements were never about the working people. These agreements were about Wall Street and the big investment and the very wealthy people.
That's right. And big agribusiness as well, who, and they're the ones really pushing for the free trade agreement right now, as well as various mining and other extractive industries, which again are, you know, will move jobs from here offshore to Colombia, where they can literally get away with murder to gain profit.
Now, literally, as we found out from the Chiquita case, which again, you know, I remember going through the whole court process, and I think the steelworkers brought the case, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we had brought similar cases against Coca-Cola and an Alabama mining company called Drummond. The Chiquita case was actually brought by the U.S. Justice Department. It was a criminal case because they admitted to paying these paramilitary groups, which had been designated by the U.S. State Department as terrorist organizations. So they were actually found criminally liable for supporting terrorist groups in Colombia. It would be like supporting Al-Qaeda. But the interesting thing is that for the penalty of paying terrorist groups, which went out and killed thousands of people, none of the Chiquita officials went to jail. They were fined $25 million, the company, and allowed to pay the $25 million over 5 years.
Nice.
Pretty incredible.
If you listen to that, I mean, really, you just... I think the average person has to go, really, are one of the benevolent U.S. corporations, a brand that we recognize and we put on our table every day, they're paying paramilitary groups to kill people in their country, and that's the pittance of a fine that they get? Just basically a slap on the wrist?
And the Justice Department let them put them on a payment plan. I hope if any of us get in trouble with the law, they put us on a payment plan to pay our fees.
I need to incorporate myself, because, you know, the more I'm looking at this corporate personhood thing, it's a pretty nice gig. You can never go to jail. They fine you a little tap on the wrist, and you get to write it off in your taxes as operating expenses.
Right. They have all the rights of persons, but very few of the responsibilities.
Amazing. Getting back to this thing with Colombia, and I think this is just insane that we're even considering it. But I remember a guy that I had interviewed a number of times. His name's Paul Craig Roberts. He was a cabinet member, an assistant secretary of the Treasury, I think, under Reagan.
And that's correct.
He had a really thoughtful quote. He said, "We're the only country in the world that gives our wealth away for nebulous foreign policy goals." And I look at the trade agreement with Colombia, and that, I think, is exactly what we're doing. It has nothing to do with American workers benefiting. We're simply saying to that country, hey, you know, thanks for sticking your thumb in the eye of Venezuela. That's my thought.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. I think the U.S. sees Colombia as, frankly, its last beachhead in Latin America, and they're trying to cling to it through any means they can. They receive more military assistance than any country in the hemisphere from the U.S., over $7 billion since the year 2000. And I think the U.S. is doing everything it can to cling to what control it has over the hemisphere. And as you say, that is what it's about. In fact, I know that's what it's about, because every time you raise principled objections to the free trade agreement, those supporting it are quick to say, well, what about that crazy Chavez, which, you know, obviously is beside the point, number one. And number two, whatever you say about him, truthfully, he is not exterminating his own people, as is true in Colombia, right, where that is happening at a massive level.
It's another example of, I think, we're backing a horse, and it's not necessarily a good one.
No.
So let's look at this trade agreement. Last question I've got for you. You know, as we're moving down this road, because I think they're going to pass. I think eventually the president will cave and they will pass this through. It'll be interesting to see where the Tea Party people come out on this. But as we move down this road, the people who are displaced, what's going to happen to them? Because the Republicans have kind of dug their heels in and they're saying no to the TAA, no help for those people who will lose their jobs because of this.
Well, I fear that the people who are displaced will end up swelling the ranks of our already large unemployed population. And there seems to be very little care that is swelling to levels, you know, to around 10%, at least officially, and probably 17% or so unofficially. And seems to be very little concern that that's happening.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what do we do to stop this? How do you stop this train? Or can we?
Well, we can, and it's going to, you know, frankly, it does take the power of labor to organize one work, you know, the workplace, but also to organize resistance and protest to this. I mean, you really see, I've never seen a situation in this country where we have massive economic dislocation of people losing their homes, losing their jobs. Meanwhile, seeing Wall Street becoming more and more enriched with profits, but refusing to hire anyone, and yet there's been very little outcry.
Now, how do we lose that? How do you lose that message when you look at the bonuses that are being handed out, you look at the pay that's being handed out, and the top 25 hedge fund managers making $1 billion a year paying 15% tax? How do you lose that argument?
I don't think you can, and that's the point, you know. But people have seemed to have lost their will to go to the streets to protest these things, and that's the spirit, frankly, we need to get back.
Yeah, I guess everyone's on the treadmill just trying to keep up.
Well, that's part of it, too. It's hard to, you know, when your stomach is hungry, it's hard to worry about those bigger things, but it affects us all.
Yeah. The piece is, the killing continues as U.S. doubles down on failed trade policies. It's over at Counterpunch. You can also get there from our site at therixsmithshow.com. Dan Kovalik, I appreciate your time. Great piece. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It was rock and roll.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
It's time for another Gooberhead Award. Presented periodically to those in the news who had their tongues running 100 miles an hour but forgot to put their brains in gear. Today, I've got two goobers from last year's teabag uprising, both of whom got elected by promising to bring common sense to Congress and take government back from the special interests. Goober number one is Arizona's Ben Quayle, the son of Dan, and truly a flake off the old block.
Ben has proven to be a stand-up guy, not for the folks, but for big oil. While voting to slash government programs to help the elderly and the poor, he has voted not once but twice to keep giving $2 billion in annual tax subsidies to the five richest oil corporations. In a town hall meeting back home, a feisty lady asked him, why? Ben essentially called her ignorant, insisting that big oil was merely getting the same tax deductions that all corporations get. It's not specific to the oil industry, he said, to which the audience burst out laughing. They were right to guffaw, for tax giveaways called intangible drilling costs and enhanced oil recovery costs are obviously specific to that industry. Has Ben lying or just a goober? Our second awardee is Sean Duffy of Wisconsin, who campaigned as a regular guy, but asked at a town hall gathering whether he'd vote to cut congressional pay as a symbolic stand with his hard-hit constituents, Sean fell into a paroxysm of self-pity. I have more debt than all of you, he wailed, adding that he can't even buy a new car on his $174,000 a year paycheck. And Duffy also complained about Congress's health and pension plans, most of which are paid for by us taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Sean, if it's such a burden being a Congress critter, quit and join the real world. What a goober.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hazes. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Well, the monthly trade figures are out. They were released this week. The overall trade deficit, $43.7 billion in April. That marks a drop of 6.7% from March. But understand, Japan had that little earthquake thing. So they're not exporting anything to us. So that's 6.7%, I don't know. And you look at a drop of 25% and imports from Japan, again, you look at that and you go, 6.7, looks like our trade deficit actually went up with everybody else. And who do you think led the way on that? That's right, the Chinese. How very nice for us. Some good news on Wall Street, if you will. The SEC is investigating whether Goldman Sachs and other financial firms violated the foreign bribery laws. Turns out, may turn out, according to the Wall Street Journal, that they had some weird things going on with the Libyans and their sovereign wealth fund. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. Again, I go back to the collapse of September of 2008. Still not seeing a bunch of people going to jail. There should be a perp walk every single day. There should be one of these criminals walking into the big house every single day. But you know, I guess it comes down to the dollars. Also, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley, he has signed their new immigration law. It's the same thing. It's basically the Arizona law that they just stamped their name on. But it not only does what everything that the Arizona law does, only a little bit more. Now what can happen is the police stop and search someone, because, of course, they're undocumented looking. They can actually hold them. They can detain them now. So, you know, I got to be honest, that's scary stuff there, too. The law also requires public schools to determine student citizenship status, and this will take effect on September 1st. So yeah, that's a great step in the right direction. Nice. And again, you know, you look in Pennsylvania, there's a bill that the Metcalf has put forth, much like this. I mean, the whole bizarre right wing agenda. We've got our T Twizzler Metcalf and his minions who are going to push that kind of stuff through. And I don't see how this is good. I don't see how this is a step in the right direction. I think it's It's just more, just being mean. Just, I don't know. Anyway, here's, and speaking of being insane, House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Peter King, he announced that we're going to have a second wave of hearings to go after those radical Muslims. This time we're going to be looking in the prisons, I guess, because Peter King sees there's a dangerous problem of radicalization in the U.S. prisons. Not that those people aren't ticked off enough for being locked up. Now we're going to go after them on another witch hunt. Don't we have better things to do? Aren't there people without jobs? Shouldn't we be working on the economy? All the polling I'm seeing, jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet all I'm seeing out of the Republicans are, let's destroy jobs. Let's destroy Social Security. Let's take away Medicare. And, oh, let's go after those Muslim people and those immigrant people. Let's do more of that. Instead of, well, I guess the reality is that they don't have a plan. They don't have an idea of what to do. So you do what got you to the dance. Anger people, tick people off, and of course suppress the vote. As we've been seeing across the country, what's working for them, I guess, is destroying people's right and their access to the ballot box. And here in Pennsylvania, no different. We're going to see that push continue, the Metcalfs of the world. The radicals of the world, and look, in Pennsylvania, they have to hold down the vote. They absolutely have to because they're about 1.2 million behind in registration with the Democrats. And they don't want to have to rely anymore on the angry independents because the independents are now angry at them. So you don't want to deal too much with that. You want to suppress all the people you can on the other side, while increasing your side of this whole thing. And Babette Joseph wrote an interesting op-ed this week talking about the voter ID thing. And just saying, look, it's not right for the Commonwealth. We've got elderly people. We've got poor people. We should be increasing access to the ballot box instead of pushing this House Bill 934, which is going to destroy it. And they keep saying, well, you know, we're gonna cut down on the number of voter impersonations. You know, they're not gonna go get those dead people, and the dead people won't vote anymore. Yet, I've yet to find anybody who can show me that this is a real problem. It seems like an awful lot of money that we're spending, and even setting up this whole photo ID thing. It seems like an awful lot of money to be spending on something that really is not a problem. But what it is, what this is all about, and understand what it really is all about. It's about taking the vote away from those Democrat people, taking it away from them senior people, those inner city people, those minorities, those Muslims. I mean, because you're going to have to, the Republicans are going to have to figure out how to hold the Latino community down, how to hold the Muslim community down, and how to hold the poor people down. You got to figure out how to do that. And this is the way. Make sure that they don't have access to the ballot box. Especially the Latino community. You look at that whole immigration thing. Their position, not very saleable. Not very saleable at all. Anyway, gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Dave. We're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Dave Philman, executive director of AFSCME Council 13, from their Young Workers, conference last week. Right back after this. And it's still not enough. They should have looked into a cap. But we never give up. We'll be here one day longer. One day longer. The people's voice is stronger. The people's voice is stronger. We work hard for our money. We work hard for respect. Keep fighting for these rights. The generation that's next. One day longer. One day longer. The people's voice. Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
$600 million. Sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? That's how much Pennsylvania loses each year because of tax loopholes that allow some big corporations making millions of dollars in our state to pay less state taxes than you or I do. $600 million. That pays for huge bonuses for corporate executives instead of state programs. Does that sound fair to you? In tough economic times, more people turn to government for help. But many programs, like those that protect children and help senior citizens, have been cut so much that some services are not available. State legislators have to bring fairness to the tax system. Instead of cutting programs, they should take a balanced approach to the budget. Make big corporations pay their fair share. Call your legislators today.
Tell them to close the loopholes, not cut vital programs. After all, that $600 million is coming out of our pockets. Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Don't have a phone? Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
There's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to therickSmithShow.com and download our podcast there for your convenience, your entertainment, there for you. I'm here at the AFSCME Council 13 Young Workers Conference. Sitting across the table from me is AFSCME Council 13's Executive Director, Dave Filman. Dave, thanks for sitting down with us.
Rick, always a pleasure to be back with you.
You know, I look at what you're doing here, and this is the kind of stuff that has to happen. We're looking across the country. Florida, for instance, tomorrow they're having a big festival to bring workers together to organize to fight back against some of the attacks. In Wisconsin, they're setting up little Walkervilles to fight against their budgets. This is the kind of stuff that we're going to have to be doing more of.
And this is the part of or point of this conference. We call it the next wave. And the folks here are primarily 35 years and younger. And, you know, they are the ones that we have to rely on to continue with the message that we have. And I tell you, Rick, if you could bottle the enthusiasm out of those folks, I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. I'm so glad we were on the cutting edge out of AFSCME to put this together. And we have a good crowd. It's about 150 young folks here. We actually have some from New York, New Jersey. There's one that's traveling in from Canada to be here with us. And it's just one of those things. It's a grassroots movement. It's just going across, and they compare. They network with each other. They tweet. They do everything. And it's really just fun to watch.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's going to have to happen. It will go back to the roots of labor. And that person-to-person organizing, or in this time, the Twitter thing that's going on. But again, you know, the right learned the lesson from labor, and they did the hard work of organizing. Now I think it's time that really we push back.
And not only that, but if you followed the what happened in Wisconsin, there was a heck of a lot of young folks out there. The University of Wisconsin was right there, Madison, and they really held the day together. I mean, it was just something, and our members here, our next waivers, saw that. They want to get involved with those issues, too. I mean, they're employed by, you know, the Commonwealth or local municipalities, but they're watching what's happening in these other states, and they're telling us, we want to get involved. We want to stop this from happening. happening. So Pennsylvania isn't a Wisconsin.
Yeah, we were out there during the height of the occupation for 9 days, and you're exactly right. It was the young people who carried the day. It was the young folks who slept in the Capitol and were there 24/7 for the entire time, which is, I got to be honest, I'm trying to convince the college kids that when they got out of school now, they should be coming to our Capitol and bringing their sleeping bags. When you look at the budget cuts that are really, really taking their future away.
It is, absolutely. We've got this balancing act now that we've got the billion and half a billion in cuts in the basic ed, the higher ed, and now we're looking at $550 million in surplus, and they're wondering, you know, what should we do with this? Well, my God, we got to go back and keep that education stuff going. We got to make sure that we've got young folk that want to go to college and can afford to go to college, and also the basic education. If we're cutting out Head Start or day-long kindergartens, I mean, we need to keep that stuff in place, because if we don't educate our young, we're going to be just worse off than we are now. We don't have manufacturing. We don't have anything. We're exporting everything. We want to keep it in here, and we need educated folks.
I mean, you look at our infrastructure. We haven't been investing in our infrastructure in 20 years. Is that what we want to do to education?
Exactly, exactly. We just keep neglecting it. It's like not changing the oil in your car. After, you know, it may last for a year or two or so, but after a while you get major damage, and that's what we have the infrastructure here in the United States, not only with education, but also just the regular roads and bridges. That's the infrastructure.
You know, at the end of this, though, and what we keep hearing from the right is, well, we have this big spending problem. We spend too much on education. We spend too much on social programs. We spend too much. I'm sorry, I'm missing that. My problem is, I think we've got a revenue problem. For 30 years, we've been giving the very wealthy in this country as much as they could pocket, as much as they could offshore. We've been giving corporations massive breaks. I think it's time to start looking at some revenue.
Absolutely. And if the whole mantra of tax cuts for the rich, you know, we had that 8 years with Bush, and it created a problem at the end of his term.
Yep.
So that was not the resolution to it, but we're still hearing that mantra over and over again, that that's what we have to do. We can't tax the rich any more than we are now, but we're in deep trouble. We need the jobs, and we need to get revenues in there, and we've got corporations making billions and billions. We got the national gas industry taking all that gas out from under us right here in Pennsylvania, not paying a darn thing on it, and that's really, really wrong.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, what's frustrating to me is we've got a governor who has taken this bizarre pledge, and Dalen Leach wrote an amazing kind of snarky piece the other day saying, you know, when we were kids, we took a whole bunch of stupid pledges that we knew we were never going to be able to uphold, but, you know, we took them anyway because, you know, we were dumb. But now we got the guy who's leading our state, the guy who's going to lead us into the future, taking one of these really ignorant pledges, and it's gonna harm us down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so much stuff. Even if he keeps to his no new taxes pledge, we've got the corporate Delaware holdings. We can lock those up, just bring millions and millions of dollars in here. That's nothing new. I mean, that's there. We've got the vendor sales tax discount. That's nothing new. We can take that away. I mean, we've got the natural gas piece. I mean, come on. That's not a tax on the taxpayers. That's a tax on money that these large corporations are making, taking that gas out of the ground in Pennsylvania. And they're the big guys, the Halliburtons, the Range Resources, the Cabots. Those guys aren't here just for a temporary time. They're here to make a lot of money.
And the key to that is we're already paying that tax. It's already in the price of the natural gas. Because they're not selling it right here in Pennsylvania. They're selling it globally. And, in fact, we've got congressmen in this state who want to be able to sell it to China. So, again, I'm trying to figure out how it is we want to use the gas that's under our feet to benefit the Chinese, and we're not going to get a taste of it. That makes absolutely no sense to me.
And not only that, but we're the only state in the nation that's not doing it. I mean, everybody else does. There's this gigantic pocket of this natural gas. It's getting out. It's being taken out, and we're not getting anything out of that. It's absolutely bizarre.
See, I'm in favor of sacrifice. If it's shared, you know, times are tough. Americans do that. They roll up their sleeves. They get their hands dirty. They sacrifice. As long as everybody's doing it. I'm not seeing the very well-to-do sacrificing. I'm seeing people in wheelchairs who are rolling into the Capitol saying, please don't cut the funding that's going to get me thrown out of my house. Please don't cut the funding that's going to have my health care aid come to my house. Those are the kind of things I think, you know, maybe we should look at first. Restore those funding cuts, and then down the road, go from there.
Yeah, and that's obviously how the budget process goes. The House budget that they passed isn't the greatest at all. They did put a little bit more back in the education. The Senate's going to take a look at it, but I don't think there's going to be astonishing changes. There's going to be little tweaks here and there, but you're right, Rick. We're cutting the folks that need it the most at these desperate times are really getting cut.
But, Dave, you know, at the end of the day, they're still hell-bent on that $27.3 billion number. And again, I'm saying we don't have a spending problem, a revenue problem. You know, in my house, when I need a little bit more money, I work a couple extra hours, I bring a little extra revenue so my kids can eat. There's only so much you can cut before you start cutting into the bone until you start harming people, and that's what I worry about. One of the big questions I did have for you, I know you guys are coming up on contract time. This is gonna get kind of hairy.
It is. We have started our negotiations actually last year under the Rendell administration by law, but we didn't start anything up until a couple months ago. And we have had quite a few sessions, just completed one yesterday, and we're going to have three in a row, June 20th, 21st, and 22nd. We still have you talk about shared sacrifice, Rick. There's a 4% wage reduction on the table for state employees that work for or members of AFSCME. I don't know of anywhere in the legislature or any other branch of the government that they are getting a reduction at all. The governor did ask for a wage freeze for school district employees, and some have and some have not. But the reduction is absolutely
that's something
not,
new.
That's something new, and it's not shared sacrifice, believe me. No one else is doing it, but we're going to continue negotiating. Hopefully in those 3 days we can come to some agreement.
You know, I look at this, and the average salary of one of your members, somewhere from what I've read, maybe I'm wrong, about $34,000.
That's absolutely right.
That's not, to me, that's not living high off the hog. That's not one of the, I guess the paper did a story. There are a couple, 3,600 that make over $100,000 a year. The vast majority of your members don't make that.
Oh, absolutely not. $34,000 is the average. They also throw in the issue about pensions. The average state employee pension is about $24,000 a year. We have 28,000 current retirees that make only $500 a month. And they retired a long time ago. They haven't had a cost of living increase in their pension for 8 years. And the reason I'm throwing that out there is because we hear these bloated figures. I heard a figure, I think it was today, that the average state salary was like $54,000. I mean, that may be true when you put in those $100,000
right.
folks and everybody else that's up there. But my members are the lowest paid, and it really is insulting to hear that the average is $54,000 when our guy's even close to that.
And what's really insulting would be to me, if I were one of your members, is, you know, making $34,000, you want me to take a 4% pay cut?
Absolutely.
When the governor himself isn't, and you're not seeing the legislature taking cuts, that would be a major slap in the face to me.
Absolutely. And that's what we're talking about. My members have, before, when there were tough times, they've taken wage freezes. They've done that. We've even offered that already to extend our contract for a year with a wage freeze. But the more we look into that, and the more we hear and see business as usual all across the legislature or throughout the business of the Commonwealth, it gets very difficult for our members to buy that credence. That's no doubt about it.
You know, in talking about your members and some of the questions I'm going to ask them here tonight, you know, I got to be honest. I don't know that I could wake up every day and have any level of morale whatsoever. I don't know that I could, you know, just talking about myself, could come in and want to do my job for the state, given the fact that every day I'm being beat up in the media. Every time you turn on local talk radio, they're demonizing me. They're telling me I'm overpaid, I'm worthless. I guess the question is how do your folks do it? Because I couldn't, and I wouldn't.
It is. And then you throw in the other stuff. When we had the budgets that weren't passed, they got laid off without pay. They had went 2.5 weeks without any pay. Eventually they got it back, but, you know, we were stuck in the middle of the budgets. And it seems like the least paid of the state employees are the ones that are shouldering a lot of the issues, a lot of the burden of trying to balance the budget or resolve the issues. And you're absolutely right, Rick. For them to go to work and knowing that they are going to get beat up you know, morally by the public. One of the interesting thing is a state legislature had proposed that they should put official use only license plates on the cars, except for the state reps and the senators.
Of course, except for them.
Yeah. I mean, now I got guys in revenue that have to go collect taxes at times. You think they're loved by the public? Of course they're not. But they want to make sure that those folks know that that's a state car that's driving around, but not the elected official. It's bizarre.
And the other part of that is our governor goes to Washington, D.C. To give a speech before the Children's Federation, the American Children's Federation or whatever Davos's group is, talking about how to privatize education. And you and I foot the bill for that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's the other thing is we're talking about, you know, privatizing almost every service in the government. Other states are doing it so much. Just a good example, there's tons of them out there, but New Jersey, quite a few years ago, had privatized their licensing services. And it was done so poorly, they brought it back in-house because, you know, my members like to do what they do.
Yep.
They don't come to work for the state government because they're going to make a heck of a lot of money, year-end Christmas bonuses, stock options. It's not there. They like the work that they do. If it's the PennDOT guy and gal that's in the middle of a snowstorm when you're told to stay home and they're out risking their lives, if it's the direct care person working on a patient in an institution, taking care of them, getting hit by them because they're just acting up, as they say, or some of parole agents are out there dealing with the offenders. I mean, these folks like their job, and it's a hell of a job, and it's a dangerous job. But they don't do it for the pay. They do it for the service to the taxpayers.
And again, you know, for me, and I've said this before, I don't know that I would do it, given the verbal beating and the image that the media has portrayed. And there's this other thing, the last thing I wanted to talk a little bit about. I heard it today again, and it's this constant frame that we need to run government like business, and that when times are tough, you need to lay off people. In a lot of the work that your members do, it's not something that can be put to the winds of the economy. You're talking about taking care of people. You're talking about plowing roads. You're talking about picking up garbage. This is not the winds of a good economy, bad economy. This is consistent stuff day in, day out. So I guess my question is when you look at that argument that they make that we need to run what you guys do in a more business-like fashion, where are they wrong?
Well, I agree. I mean, you have to separate government and business the way it operates. There's no doubt about it. A good example is the natural gas business we were just talking about. We've had problems with some of the wellheads. We've had problems with explosions. We've had problems with contamination. And the folks that protect that are the folks at the Department of Environmental Protection, DEP. DEP got hit worse than the last two budgets, losing a lot of folks, so now we have less folks over there to be able to take care of the permits, to be able to take care of monitoring the gas operations.
Well, that's by design.
By design. But now people complain they can't get the permits done because there's so many gas applications in there. Well, of course not. You laid people off. So to say there has to be, you're absolutely right, Rick, that you have to have some sort of a different criteria when it comes to government, because right now when the economy is the worst is when you need the most government employees to take care of unemployment, welfare, EBT, whatever that is, in addition to everything else that goes down there. So the balance is, it's not apples and apples.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Dave Filmon, Executive Director, Ask Me Council 13. I appreciate your time. This is a great, great, great thing you're doing here. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for your work, too.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Ask Me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death? No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Fillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, one divided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call our brothers and our sisters. And are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can rely on it. The time is prime, fans aligned and no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. A sleeping giant. Come on, yeah, we can do it. We need to revive, re-air, and re-up the labor movement. Anything in life worth having is worth fighting for. We're in a fight to bring the middle class back, and we ain't even planning on losing in this mighty war. The working class is under attack. Anything in life worth having is worth fighting for. We're in a fight to bring the
middle. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Some interesting news from Florida. I think I could do a whole 3 hours just on news out of Florida. Anyway, the other day there was the woman who was drunk driving topless. Well, today in East Naples, Florida, the news report comes a Florida woman was arrested after witnesses said she exposed herself at an apartment complex community pool. She probably just wanted to, take a little tumble. Collier County Sheriff's Deputies Rachel Gomez of East Naples appeared drunk and was stumbling Saturday when she removed her bikini top while talking to a man at the River Reach Apartments about 1:45 p.m. Gomez had her top on when a deputy arrived, and she told him that it had fallen off accidentally earlier. The deputy said Gomez smelled strongly of alcohol and ignored him when he attempted to question her. He said Gomez was uncooperative when he asked for identification and was arrested when she attempted to walk away and refuse orders. She was arrested after a brief struggle and charged with misdemeanor counts of obstructing an officer and resisting law enforcement without violence. What happened to the good old days? When, if someone took their top off for you, you said thank you. I don't know. I'm not getting this. Why? I'm just not getting it. Also from Florida, another one of these videotape stories. A woman was taped taking 75 deodorant sticks from a Winn-Dixie store there, which is kind of like a corner drugstore. But why would you need? Did she smell that bad? 75. Deodorant sticks. A judge there in Fort Lauderdale has also ruled that running a red light, one of these things that in Florida, I guess they do differently. If a cop stops you, pulls you over for running a red light, they charge you, I think it's like $280. But if they catch you with the camera, it's only $158. Well, the judge there said that is unconstitutional. So now if you get caught, I'm sure this is what's going to happen. If you get caught running a red light by the camera, you're going to probably pay the $280. And personally, I want to be pulled over. I want to be stopped, and I want the cop to have the job. I'm in favor of people having jobs. This is a good place to start. New York, and this is one of those stories that go, how could you make this argument even straight-faced? This gentleman's club, Night Moves, up near Albany, New York, they were trying to claim that a private lap dance should be exempt from taxes, should be tax-free because it's a dramatic or musical art performance. The New York court ruled, no, you're going to have to pay tax on that. And, you know, being up there in the state capitol there in New York, I wonder how many lawmakers were, you know, funneling the money there into the fund, if you will, and how much tax revenue didn't get collected because, you know, it's exempt. Come on, what's wrong with that? It's exempt. You know, just a little charity. In fact, I would think it would be a charitable thing. You know, most of those guys that go in there, they, you know, charitable thing. That's maybe down the road they'll mark it off as a charitable deduction. I don't know. Here's an interesting story for parents. The cost of a middle-income family to raise their children, now nearly $230,000. If you had a kid this year or last year, you're expected to spend somewhere around $226,970 over the next 17 years, according to a report released on Friday. The United States Department of Agriculture's annual expenditures on children by families report, in which the figures were published, is used as a guide in setting child support and foster care. So, guys, looks like you're in trouble because $230,000. You think about that, you know, kids with going to college and, you know, dentures. You know, my daughter's 9. They're talking about dentures. They're talking about putting braces on my kid, 9. I'm going, shouldn't that wait till high school? But I guess they're doing this stuff a lot earlier. For lower income families, those earning less than $57,600 a year, parents can expect to spend a total of $166,000 as their child finishes high school. Families earning over $100,000 a year, you're going to spend about $377,000 over that 17-year span. Here again, you know, going back to this unemployment thing, bringing this back home. Again, they're working on this really, really bad draconian bill. And what's coming down to, and understand, is we've got about a week left. And next week is going to be the big week, because next Saturday is the deadline. If we don't get something passed by next Saturday, something like 44,000 people almost immediately lose their benefits, because the federal money that gives them an extension will be cut off because we don't have a plan. And I truly believe this is deliberately done by the Republicans to create a last-minute crisis to say, oh, we got to get something done as quick as possible because there's 44,000, 45,000 people out there who are going to suffer if we don't. Let's do something. And then you're going to see them ram through the most draconian bill possible, which is why they're taking out all of the big sloppy wet kisses to big business and putting it in the Senate Bill 1030, which is why right now, call their office. Right this minute, call the office, leave a voicemail. In the morning, call again, leave a voicemail. Call early, call often, because this 13-week lifeline for those 45,000 families is vitally important to get into the middle of the hiring season, because we're moving into that. And now is not the time to say, well, you know, sorry, buddy, tough luck. But that's what they want to do. And you go back through this bill, and you go back through what they want to put into it. Senate Bill 1030 was already a compromise bill to begin with. And what they want to do is, again, like I said, they want to take the really draconian stuff, the really pro-business stuff, and they want to ram it into this 1030. They want to make sure that they get everything. Look, a good crisis doesn't come along all that often, and they want to exploit this as much as possible, make sure that they get their 10 pounds of flesh, not just a pound. That's why we've got to stand up, fight back right now. This is not going to be good for us. Anyway, I want to thank all the guests we had tonight. Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Roger Hickey from Campaign for America's Future. Michael Linden, our good friend, Director of Tax and Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. And, of course, Dan Kovalik, Human Rights and Labor Rights Attorney from Pittsburgh. And our good friend Dave Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. Have a great weekend. We'll be back in the studio live and in person to take your calls Monday. We'll see you then. Have a great weekend.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Let's get right to it. HR 6419. I am flipping mad over this. WTF, man. WTF is the only thing I can think of. The Emergency Unemployment Compensation Continuation Act, H.R. 6419. They needed to get two-thirds.